Good evening and welcome to the study session of October the 4th, 2016. Let's go around the table and identify ourselves for the record, please.
Toby Nixon.
Penny Sweet.
Dave Asher.
Jay Arnold.
Kurt Triplett.
Shelley Kloba. And Amy Wallen. Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. City Manager.
All right. So thank you, Madam Mayor, members of the Council. So our study session today is on animal services, and in particular a presentation from King County about the regional animal services provided by King County. I think, as everybody knows, we are currently in a contract with King County that goes through 2017. And our region has been having a discussion, which we've been a participant in, about a new regional contract that would extend 5 years beyond 2017. And those negotiations are fairly close to being done, and so King County is going out and talking to the regional partners and saying, here's what's in the potential contract, and asking cities whether they want to sign up for that extended contract. So today we're going to have King County make a presentation and have questions or comments from any of the council members about the potential proposal, and then we'll be concluded. So here from King County, we have Diane Carlson and Jean Mueller, who are going to give us the presentation and be available to answer any questions.
Welcome, Diane.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here, especially in your new facility. It is lovely and wonderful, and it still has a very new carpet smell, which is nice. So thank you, and thanks very much for allowing us to come in make this presentation. We're really excited to be able to talk to you about the successes of regional animal services, and we really are very appreciative of Kirkland's participation in the program over the years. You are, with Lori's work over the last couple of years, really kind of a model of in our program of a city that's really taken to the goals of animal services, protecting people, and humane care for animals. So you guys have really supported it well, and we really appreciate that. So Dr. Mueller is here with me, and we're going to tag team this a little bit. Dr. Jean Mueller is the director of Regional Animal Services and runs the program, and I think he's probably presented to you before. So you know he's very accomplished and can answer and will answer all of your questions about the services of the program, how we provide services, and what we're looking at for changes. Let me see if I can figure it. Yep, there we go. So tonight we really just want to give you a quick overview of what we do in regional animal services, touch base with you on kind of how the current services work, and particularly try to answer some of the questions that you may have about specifically about Kirkland services. And then I'll finish up with a quick run through of changes that we have worked out with the cities for the agreement in principle, which would be the ILA moving forward after 2017. So I'm going to have Jean come up and start with the services overview.
Thank you very much. I'm Jean. It's very nice to see you all. Thank you for your time. Here's our pet of the week. We have a lot of social media activity as well, getting animals out adopted. We're serving 25 contract city partners as well as unincorporated King County. We serve a little over 1 million residents and almost 500,000 dogs and cats. We have 3 core services. We provide field services, the emergency response and dealing with neighborhood nuisance issues. We supply shelter services for those animals. And we supply licensing services. Additionally, sort of attendant to those other 3 main buckets, we respond to a sizable number of public disclosure requests, individuals wanting to follow up on complaints, notices of violations, tickets that they may have received. We also respond to media inquiries and try and work with community organizations to deal with animal issues. We're wholly contained in the sense that all of the activities, all of our enforcement activities are run through King County, so we adjudicate all of the infractions that occur and are issued NOVs by our animal control officers, and we conduct animal cruelty investigations and follow up. And in severe instances, we're working with the local law enforcement on those particular issues. Some of the benefits of a larger system is the ability to be consistent across jurisdictions, the ability to follow people and animals when they move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So it's not just starting over for an individual who perhaps is negligent with their animals. It's also helpful for residents to have a single access point to make contact regarding domestic animal issues. We feel it helps to reduce demand on individual jurisdictions, and again, this is dealing with public disclosure requests, dealing with media, having our PIOs responding to issues, dealing with advocacy groups. We have several of our cities have remarked that they appreciate having their police freed up to do traditional law enforcement, and having the local court system not having to deal with animal civil appeal processes is helpful as well. We keep that out of your court systems and run that currently through the hearing examiner for King County. And as well, when we have appeals or issues that go into court, we're the ones who are defending our actions, and the cities are they're not involved. We also appreciate our wide network of volunteers, partnerships with community organizations, and our foster families. We have a sizable partner list here. These are the three field service districts for animal control. The farthest north 200 contains Kirkland and several of your adjoining cities. District 200 essentially runs from Shoreline out to Carnation. The middle district 220 runs the 90 corridor. And District 500, the most sizable, both in population and activity, is down in South King County, including Kent, where we have the main shelter. Here's a map of those districts. You can see the geographic distribution. For field service, we're handling about 5,000 requests for service per year. We have more contact than that because often cases need follow-up, additional work done, animals to be picked up. And on average, for between 2013 and 2015, we have about 257 field calls in Kirkland annually. When we took a quick look at what enforcement has been occurring in the city of Kirkland, we looked at 2015 notices of violations. And we have also the ability to issue written warning notices, and we have 11 warning notices that were issued. Those are typically issues like trespass, first event. We've also issued 54 notices of violation, and 12 of those notices of violation had actually requested hearings at the KC Board of Appeals, all handled through Regional Animal Services. And just for an example of what the NOVs are from, the warnings and NOVs are listed there with the most severe, cruelty and neglect being only one instance, to more serious issues related to dog bites with notices and orders for confinement and vicious animal determinations as well. The largest one is license infraction, following up on those. The shelter down in Kent is a great place. I hope you all can come visit at some point. We do all of the kenneling, adoptions, the return to owners. We have our veterinary clinic down on site in Kent. We have two shelter veterinarians full-time and three licensed vet techs. We provide seven-day-a-week care, both from care and feeding, but also medical care. We have about 5,000 intakes a year, and we have a significant source of animals being stray. Almost 60% of our animals come to us without an owner, often in poor physical condition, and we work with our veterinary staff and our foster volunteers to get those animals healthy and placed for adoption. As we can see, we have over 1,000 placements in foster care homes in 2015, and that can be underage feral kittens. We do handle feral cats. We handle feral kittens. We are currently operating a TNR clinic working with three feral cat organizations to try and stop the reproduction of feral cats. We are very fortunate to be supported by over 600 volunteers annually. Last year in 2015, we had 93,000 hours of support from volunteers, with the lion's share being our foster volunteers with over 70,000 hours. But we did have 22,000 hours, essentially 11 FTEs equivalent of volunteer assistance down at the shelter or at our Eastside Pet Adoption Center at Petco. And we do have volunteers that reside in Kirkland, and we deeply appreciate all their help, particularly at the Eastside Pet Adoption Center. We feel it is a high success public shelter. We do some really extraordinary things. A lot of our extraordinary veterinary work is done through Angel Fund donations, so they can go have orthopedic surgery or see the specialists. That is one of the ways we keep our shelter euthanasia so low. And we're certainly very proud of our euthanasia rate in 2015 reaching a low of 12%. And it is important to point out that by ordinance, we're required to include a number of euthanasias that most nonprofits do not include, and that is owner-requested euthanasia. So individuals bringing us aged or sick animals, we will provide that final mercy, if you will. But we do have to count it. Here's just a graph of the decline in euthanasia rate for King County Animal Control and then Regional Animal Services. Within the early 2000s, almost half of the animals that were entering the system were being destroyed. Again, we're very proud and very thankful for our partnership with the participating cities that help support the work that we do to help these animals get back in a loving home. We also do licensing, and right now, this little ad with Getting Lost is Scary is the current Facebook ad that we're running in partnership with some of the direct mail that we have out and some of the canvassing we're doing. It's a unified system for marketing pet licenses. We have direct mail. We have email blasts. We have a blog now. We are very active in social media. We have over 5,000 people who are following us on either Facebook, Twitter, or all those other social media apps that I have no idea what they do. We're also pleased that we have over 100,000 pets licensed in the program currently, and we have over 450 pet license sales partners, and we get involved with the cities. We have marketing meetings quarterly with them. We're involved in their community events, work with them on specific mailing programs. Again, we have robust web and social media presence, and we also provide, at the city's request, neighborhood marketing, which is also known as canvassing, which is a great investment on future returns.
I have a question for you, Jean.
Please.
Ms. Kalba. And this actually goes back one slide, although I really like that cute cat with big eyeballs. So you actually keep it there. But that decline in euthanasia, I know I read in the packet of the variety of reasons why you would do the euthanasia, but I can't remember if any of it is due to we're out of space.
Never.
And this animal has been here X amount of time. Their time is up. They got to go. That's not one of the reasons you would do it.
No, it's not.
Okay.
All of the animals that are given that final mercy are either irreparably medically ill. And actually, if you wanted to see one of our euthanasia reports, it actually lists out the reason. So it's either a severe medical issue. And even some of those we keep going as long as possible by placing them in a golden oldie foster home. A senior who wants to help and has some time, we support them both from a veterinary standpoint and a food standpoint. And that cat lives, it's, you know, months in comfort, and then we'll apply that final ending for them. The only other ones that would be destroyed would be vicious dogs. So if we have a dog that we've either seized because it is a violator, it's been deemed vicious and now has been out again and bitten somebody else, we will go through the legal process to have that animal essentially turned over to Regional Animal Services. And unless there's a special reason, we'll destroy that animal. That's that's the scope of animals that would be at risk for euthanasia. Pet licensing, we've been very proud of the work that we've been able to do in concert with the City of Kirkland. Since 2011 through 2015, we've been able to work with you to grow your pet license revenue over 50%, a little over $180,000 to about $280,000. That's great work, and it shows that we're able to work in concert with a great jurisdiction like yours and raise the revenue to cover some of the costs of animal services. And I'd like to turn it over to Diane now.
Okay, so we have been meeting with the city staff for probably about 8 months, 9 months now, to work through potential changes in the interlocal agreement for the next 5 years. It's been very cordial, and we've actually been able to think, streamline, and simplify. We have a very complicated interlocal agreement right now, so this is a simpler model. We, in agreement, have decided not to change any of the districts, so the three districts that you saw on the map, those would remain the same. The cost allocation would also remain the same. So if you may or may not recall, it's 80% is based on use and 20% is based on population. That's how we allocate out the cost to the three different services. And the one change this year is to use a three-year average for the rolling average for the usage so that we're not... we saw some variations when we just used the previous year for the use calculation, and so this helps kind of smooth it out a little bit for the cities so that there's not so much up and down. And we had a very complicated way of doing that in the current interlocal agreement, so this is a little bit simpler. We asked for a five-year term. We have been on a two- or three-year term for the previous interlocal agreements. It essentially means that we get into it and we have to turn it right around and start working with the cities to extend it. So we're looking at a five-year for this interlocal agreement with an automatic five-year extension, but an option to get out at that five-year term. And if any cities chose to get out after the first 5 years, then we would have a limited reopener with the remaining cities to modify the contract to adjust for that. If the implication of a city getting out was greater than 10% cost implication to any of the partners. We would allow for latecomers as long as bringing a new partner in did not negatively impact any of the existing partners. The shelter credits we are retaining. So, and this says no transition or licensing support credits, but the transition credit really is going to continue. And shelter credits are applied to cities that have a high shelter usage. So you are not one of those cities. They are... I think all in the South End, cities that happen to be mostly closer to the shelter location. So we are continuing that and have proposed to continue that at the same level that they are currently, or similar level as they're currently getting. We do have a provision in the current interlocal agreement that jurisdictions that have revenues that are greater than their costs, like the City of Kirkland, that extra money can be used by the city for services, or and if it isn't used, it goes back into the kind of the pool, and then it's distributed for the benefit of all the cities. That's how it currently works. The new interlocal agreement, what we are proposing, is that those funds would go to help reduce some of the county general fund expenses that are put into the system. And I have a slide coming up that kind of shows you where the county supports the system, and the cities are not charged for those costs. So just a note for you, we did provide all of the cities with an estimate of costs for 2018 with Kirkland in the model and one with Kirkland out of the model at the request of the city manager and Lori. So we did hear that you were interested in having us do that. So all of the cities have that information.
Dan, question for you, Ms. Weeks.
If the other cities allowed mm-hmm. canvassing, mm-hmm. wouldn't that change the outcome of that report?
It would change the individual city's outcome. So cities that, and a number of cities have actually taken up on the canvassing offer in recent years that had not pursued it before, and it's a very successful program, as Dr. Mueller indicated. So if, for example, kind of like Kirkland has done, if a city takes advantage of that, those revenues accrue to that city. So we cover the costs of the program, but there are revenues that generally occur above that. So it helps the individual city primarily if they canvass. Does that make sense?
It helped the whole bottom line, wouldn't it, if everybody canvassed?
We have structured this in a way that if a city was producing more revenue than their costs and it went back into the pool, yes, it would help the whole bottom line. But most cities are not in that situation. So you're one of the few cities that actually has been raising more revenue than costs. So yes, if they all did that, we'd have more money generally available to everyone. But most cities, it would just go to help them reduce their net cost. I went backwards, didn't I? There we go. This is the slide that shows you the county contribution to the program. In 2015 and 2016, we contributed the county $5.2 million of general fund. So about a third of that is due to our county costs. So us as a partner, just like a city as a partner. So for the unincorporated King County, costs us about $1.6 million. The other two-thirds, half of that goes to those credits that I was talking about for the high shelter use cities. The other half is used to essentially pay for some services that are outside of the model. So those are costs that don't get passed on to the cities. It helps us achieve that shelter euthanasia rate outcome. We also have some central services costs that we have not have chosen not to pass on to the cities.
Question for you, Mr. Arnold.
The proposed contract is 5 years, mm-hmm. and this $3.6 million of funding that King County is providing is something that's determined within the County Council-approved budget, which
Correct.
Is every 2 years.
Correct.
If future county councils chose not to add this $3.6 million subsidy, mm-hmm. is that a triggering event to opt out of the contract?
It would be a triggering event to require us to come back and renegotiate a contract because we have built in service levels and we have also built into this proposed contract essentially the shelter credits to these cities. So if in some situation in the future the council chose not to fund it, we would have to go back to the cities and say we can't actually provide the services that we've agreed to in this, and so we'll need to renegotiate or terminate the contract.
Could you follow up offline on where in the agreement mm-hmm. that is a triggering event? Because okay. from your previous slide and from my read of the packet, it mm-hmm. showed a city opting out was a triggering event, but it
yes.
was not clear to me that the county is. And I'd like to understand where you see what language okay. you're relying on that.
Okay. And I will clarify that the council, the executive proposed continuing the general fund contribution at the same level mm-hmm. for the 2017 and 2018 budget. So it would cover the amounts that you see there, and then we would seek obviously council approval of the agreement, which obviously they can come back during a different budget time to amend that, but it is the county's kind of commitment to serving that contract throughout its 5-year term. So
okay. thank you,
but I can come back offline and give
Great.
You an answer to that.
Thank you.
So this is the Kirkland slide, which you may have in a slightly different format. This is the 2018 model estimate under this proposed agreement in principle. So we did break up your cost allocation here into the 80%, 20%. So you can see how much is attributed to your population and how much is attributed to your use. So first couple lines there are your cost proposed for field services. Then you'll see the shelter costs and the licensing costs below that. So the total estimated cost is $270,800. Your pet license revenue is $284,000, leaving $13,000 in extra funds that under the proposal, again, the city could use it or it comes back to the system into King County under the proposal. This is the timeline, and I do want to, just note that what we have done is work through an agreement in principle with the cities, and all of the cities are out talking about it now. What we intend to do then is hear back from the cities. We will gather again at the beginning of the year. We have opportunity to modify this agreement. We're writing it now based on the agreement in principle, but we obviously will come back and talk to the cities about potential changes that we need to make once we hear back from cities. So we are asking for a non-binding commitment by the end of the year, by which time we also will have our county budget approved. And then we would try to turn that around with the cities and have a final contract available to you by March. So actually before March, because we would ask you to make a final decision by March. So with that, happy to answer questions. I know that you had some questions I think we could answer if you're interested.
Thank you, Diane. Mr. Arnold.
Thank you. One thing that was in the packet, not part of your presentation, was the idea of enhanced services. Mm-hmm. And in addition to cost containment, some of the interest in the committee discussions that we've had as a council is the opportunity for enhanced services. Is that something that, one, revenue in excess of those costs that you said could apply to enhanced services? And is that something that's got to be decided as part of contract time, or could they be added as we see the revenue, actual revenues in that are above our costs
for this year?
It does not have to be decided upon at the time of the contract. So it's flexible depending on the city's need. And Gene can talk a little bit about what those services are and what we've done for other cities.
Certainly park patrols, different enforcement techniques, desire to canvas with officers a given area because there's been a concern regarding off-leash dogs, things like that.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions or comments for Diane? Ms. Sweet?
Dr. Mueller mentioned a half million dogs and cats, but only 100,000 licensed.
Yeah, 20%.
How do we know that?
We estimate the number of companion animals based on the American Veterinary Medical Association's phone survey technique, where we can estimate the number of dogs and then separately the number of cats based on the number of households. So it's a uniform way to create an estimate by jurisdiction. We know the number of pet licenses, so then we can create the percentage that we would estimate to be licensed. And it ranges, obviously, in different areas of the county, with unincorporated King County having, mainly because of canvassing, having a prevalence of licensing that probably approaches 30%, and other areas in the county that are less than 10%. It's not unique. So City of Chicago has a license rate of dogs only of less than 8%. But how much effort do you put into it is the return that you get. Thank you.
Just one more comment.
Sure.
I really think that I don't understand why cities can opt out of canvassing.
Well, what we try and do, we're very, very fortunate. We're working with Kent for this summer, canvassing their large population. And we're hoping that that experience will help others in South King County in particular understand both the gentle approach of education that we take with it and the financial rewards for the system if they do canvassing. It is helpful for residents to know all of the services that are provided, you know, dealing with neighborhood livability issues, animal issues they may have themselves, access to spay-neuter clinics and things like that. And those canvassers can help direct those inquiries and help them solve problems. Thank you.
Are there questions or comments? Yes, Mr. Arnold, please.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, I'm curious about the public records requests and the civil appeal process. Do you have information on how many of those there are that are related to Kirkland? Probably not, but maybe for the whole system. And what are people filing public record requests about animal services? That's really curious to me.
Generally in response to following up on NOVs. So we issue notices of violation, tickets, for lack of a better word. So we issue probably something in the order of 2,000 citations for various infractions throughout the jurisdiction. And we do, as part of any appeal process, we actually send them all of their relevant records so that they have full information about what the issue is, what they've been charged with, what's the information we have so that they can successfully defend themselves in front of previously the Board of Appeals, now the hearing examiner, or to be able to talk to an attorney about the issue and have the information necessary to get prudent legal advice.
Mr. Arnold?
I just wanted to wrap up and say my family is one of the foster volunteers in Kirkland. We fostered some 24 cats, and regardless of what we do as a council in Kirkland, I just want to say hats off to you on the program that you're running and the success that you're having. What we see firsthand is just very impressive.
But it's because of you and the others like you that we're as successful as we are. It is the love of residents, of pets, that enables us to do so much.
Other comments? Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming to Kirkland. City Manager?
So that's all we had prepared for this topic.
Okay.
At future council meetings, we'll come back and talk, particularly during the budget process, about options where King County may choose to do its own animal services. But we wanted to make sure you had, you know, a chance to hear from the county directly and answer any questions that you had.
Okay. So we'll return at 7:30 for our regular meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're live here.
Good evening and welcome back. We're back in a session following a study session related to animal services. Councilmember Marcioni is absent from tonight's meeting. Is there a motion to excuse her?
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. Moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to excuse Ms. Marcioni's absence. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, say no. Thank you very much. That motion is approved. And Ms. Anderson, would you call the roll for the regular meeting, please?
Councilmember Nixon?
Here.
Councilmember Kloba?
Here.
Councilmember Asher?
Here.
Councilmember Sweet?
Here.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Here.
Mayor Wallen?
Here. Thank you very much. The first item on our agenda is under honors and proclamations. It's Walk Your Child to School Week proclamation. City Manager.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor, members of the council. So this is a proclamation that we do every year. As you know, October 5th is International Walk to School Day to promote safe and healthy lifestyles for kids in schools. And in Kirkland, we declare an entire week. And we do this in partnership with the Lake Washington School District. And we have 10 elementary schools that are participating this week in Walk Your Child to School Week. And I know many of the council members have had an opportunity to either be at an elementary school or you're going to go to an elementary school this week. So Today, to receive the proclamation, we have representatives from the schools and some of the children who are at the elementary schools, and they'll be coming up and joining you for the reading of the proclamation.
Great. And Councilmember Nixon will be reading this proclamation with me. Thank you.
We can have all the kids and parents come on up.
All right, a proclamation of the City of Kirkland proclaiming October 3rd through the 7th, 2016, as Walk Your Child to School Week in Kirkland, Washington. Whereas the National Center for Safe Routes to School, a group working to improve safety and health and working conditions for children, encourages local communities to support International Walk to School Day and similar activities. I think I said working conditions. That's probably a good thing, too. Walking conditions. Whereas walking or biking to school supports an active, healthy lifestyle through a common and enjoyable form of exercise and teaches children the skills to walk and bicycle safely and to identify safe routes to school, including portions of the Cross Kirkland Corridor as designated by the Lake Washington School District. And whereas Kirkland voters approved the Street Maintenance and Pedestrian Safety Levy in 2012, which provides annual funding toward creating and enhancing school walk routes to elementary schools. And whereas the City of Kirkland recognizes the importance of pedestrian safety and has constructed multiple improvements to school walk routes across the city, including sidewalk extensions and 34 rapid flashing beacons at strategic school and other crosswalk sites since 2013. And whereas the City Council adopted a Safe Routes to School map in March of 2014, and whereas children and parents in Kirkland are encouraged to walk or bicycle to school every day, but particularly during the week of October 3rd through the 7th, 2016, now, therefore, Amy Wallen, Mayor of Kirkland, does hereby proclaim the week of October 3rd through the 7th, 2016, as Walk Your Child to School Week in the City of Kirkland, Washington, and encourages Kirkland residents to participate in this annual event and to always consider the safety of pedestrians and bicyclists. Signed, Amy Wallen, Mayor. Okay, so who's officially receiving the proclamation?
Who walked to school today?
I did.
All right, here you go. You can be the official recipient. All right, take a picture of him holding it.
I'm
going
to take this.
Read it.
Quick on the uptake.
Come on, look over here.
Oh, smile for me.
I don't know how to smile.
Thanks. Thank you all very much.
Thank
Would you like
you.
To say anything? No? No, this is for you. Or do we want to get it to the school district? What do you want to do?
I'll give it to my principal.
Will you?
Yeah, we'll give it to Mr. Thatcher.
That would be lovely.
That would be excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Sure.
Thanks for being here tonight. So the next item on our agenda is another very important proclamation. It is Arbor Day. City Manager.
Yes, Arbor Day. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So we'll be proclaiming Saturday, October 15th as Arbor Day in the City of Kirkland. Since 2001, we have actually always selected Arbor Day to coincide with a Green Kirkland Partnership reforestation project. So Saturday the 15th, our project will be to help restore part of the forest at O.O. Denny Park. And then this will be followed by a ceremonial planting of a native tree to last for future generations. So here to receive the proclamation is our urban forester, Deb Powers, and Sharon, the head of our Green Kirkland Partnership.
Great, thank you. And Councilmember Sweet will be reading this proclamation.
You're very green, Sharon.
These are all natural, in nature, colors of green.
That's right.
This is a proclamation of the City of Kirkland, proclaiming October the 15th, 2016, as Kirkland Arbor Day in Kirkland, Washington. Whereas Arbor Day is observed around the world to celebrate, plant, and care for trees, and whereas by proclaiming and celebrating Arbor Day each year, Kirkland meets Tree City USA criteria set forth by the National Arbor Day Foundation. And whereas celebrating Arbor Day fulfills Kirkland Urban Forestry Strategic Management Plan objectives, supporting the community's vision for a livable and sustainable Kirkland today and for future generations. And whereas Green Kirkland Partnership volunteers celebrate Arbor Day by planting an abundance of native trees in open space areas, contributing to a resilient, healthy urban forest. Now, therefore, Amy Wallen, Mayor of Kirkland, does hereby proclaim Saturday, October the 15th, 2016, as Kirkland Arbor Day, and encourages residents to appreciate the value of trees and support their protection. Signed this fourth day of October, 2016, by Amy Wallen, our mayor.
Thank you, and thank you, city manager and staff and citizens. It's not easy balancing growth and livability in cities, and sometimes trees, whether they're public trees and parks in the Cross Kirkland corridor, street trees or private trees, are at the center of that very challenging balancing act. And the reason trees are so important as far as livability goes, that they clean trees, vegetation, and soil all clean and reduce contaminated surface water runoff into Lake Washington. Trees filter particulates and remove toxic gases from the air and remove carbon from the atmosphere. So thank you, Madam Mayor and City Council, staff, and the citizens in attendance for proclaiming Arbor Day tonight with us. Please feel welcome to come and celebrate with us on Saturday at O.O. Denny Park from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. There's a free pizza lunch. And you can sign up online through greenkirkland.org.
Right. So please come and join the Green Kirkland Partnership. Bring your family, bring your friends. We've had volunteers working since the end of last year to clear invasive species at O.O. Denny Park, and we're now ready for planting. We have ordered hundreds of plants, including over 80 native trees to plant that day, and so we need you to come and help us plant them. We can take up to 150 volunteers that day. So come along and join us. We do restoration of the natural forest and restoration of the community. Come and meet your friends and make new friends and get a good workout doing some planting and a free lunch. So we'll see you on October the 15th at O.O. Denny Park at 10 o'clock in the morning. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Their passion is very infectious. I definitely want to go plant some trees. All right. The next item on our agenda is under communications. It's items from the audience. This is the time in our meeting when we hear from the public on matters which are not quasi-judicial or otherwise scheduled for public hearing. We ask that not more than three people speak on any one subject. However, if both proponents and opponents wish to speak, then up to three proponents and up to three opponents may address the council. Thank you, Kathy. The first person to have signed in is Emily Newcomer. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much. I actually really just wanted to take this time to introduce myself. My name is Emily Newcomer, ironically enough. I am a new representative with Waste Management serving the city of Kirkland. I'm replacing John Chelmanek, whom some of you may know. He's still with the company but has moved into a different position. I come with a lot of industry knowledge most recently. Hopefully I won't offend anyone. I was overseeing the recycling and solid waste program at the University of Washington. Go Dogs. And this is actually my second tour of duty with Waste Management. In my previous position, I actually served as the public education manager. And so I'm excited to be working with John again and with the city of Kirkland. And so just wanted to let you know, if you have any issues with your recycling or solid waste, please do not hesitate to reach out to me. Waste Management loves being your service provider and has for the last 30 years. So,
thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
We look forward to working with you. We've reached the end of our sign-in sheet. Is there anyone else who wishes to address the council? Seeing none, I'll declare this items from the audience period closed, and we will move on to special presentations. The first one is the King County Solid Waste Transfer Station update. City Manager.
Okay, very nice segue from the items from the audience. So at the request of the council a few meetings back, there's a lot happening right now at King County with the solid waste transfer system, and the council thought it would be a good idea to sort of bring everybody back up to speed, since it's been quite a while since we've had a formal presentation at the council. So we had quite a bit of background material in your packets, but what we want to do is give a brief overview of that tonight and just answer any questions. And really, the goal of tonight is to have all the council kind of on the same education place in case actions break at King County and we need some direction from the council. So that's our hope tonight. And here to provide that is John McGilvery, our solid waste supervisor.
Thank you, City Manager, and good evening, Mayor Wallen and City Council members. So brevity is my goal tonight, so if I'm moving through this too fast, please yank on the reins a little bit and I'll slow down and answer questions. So if you recall, back in 2005, the city signed a memorandum of understanding with King County. And in that memorandum of understanding, the county committed to closing the Houghton Transfer Station for a number of reasons. It's obviously located in a neighborhood and it doesn't meet a lot of the standards of a new station. And so that transfer plan was passed in 2006, and the commitment was made by King County to close that station in about 2016 at the time. Between 2006 and 2016, they've implemented that transfer plan, and you can see from the map there, it's a little bit of a glare there, but you can see up north, Shoreline was opened in 2009. Bow Lake was opened in 2013, and then I think some of you have had the opportunity to tour the brand new Factoria transfer station in Bellevue that just opened this year. Down south, in Algona, they're looking at a couple of different locations, one in Auburn, one right next to the current location, Algona, for the new transfer station. Of course, now you have in the north there by Houghton, the northeast region, which with a big question mark there. And so, if you recall, back in 2010, the county came to cities asking that they consider extending their interlocal agreements with the county through 2040 so the county could issue longer-term bonds to fund that transfer plan system. And the longer-term bonds would allow for lower rates over the long term, but obviously higher debt service. And so our presumption was at that time when we signed that extended agreement that that funding would be used to complete the transfer station plan, which meant the closure of Houghton. In 2013, Kirkland, along with 31 other cities, signed the new ILA. Bellevue and the Point Cities opted not to. Bellevue accounts for about 10% of the tonnage in the system, so King County said, well, let's wait a second. Let's see if we actually need a new northeast station. And so we ended up with a review of the transfer station plan. It's important to note in 2014 that the Kirkland City Council did weigh in on two separate occasions with resolutions, basically saying that we want Houghton closed And also we want a concurrent siting process with whatever the county is doing. Let's start looking at sites right now. And so that ticks off several years off the process. It can take up to 3 years to even find a suitable location. And so in the final transfer plan in 2015, the Northeast Transfer Station was remained on the table, but they said they're not going to build it now, and they're going to see if they can find a way to not build it by implementing demand management strategies. And so in 2015 and 2016, the MISWAC Demand Management Subcommittee was formed to look at those demand management strategies. And just late-breaking news, the King County Council actually just passed a disposal fee for 17 and 18, which funds that demand management strategy pilot about $2 million for that. And so this is where we are right now in terms of what we would look if we didn't have a new Northeast station in Houghton closed. We would have all of the tonnage Kirkland North going to Shoreline and then Redmond South going to Factoria. In terms of our involvement in the demand management subcommittee, Kirkland, Bellevue, Bothell, Redmond, and Woodinville all participated. We had council members Sweet and Nixon also participated in that subcommittee. Basically, as I'd said, we were looking at strategies that we could employ to divert transactions from Houghton to north to Shoreline and south to Factoria. And it's important to note, too, that all of these assumptions assume that we will achieve a 70% recycling rate by 2020. And less disposed materials means less transactions. And so the county is committed to conducting a pilot in 2018 with the funding that they've been given. And there's a couple of key recommendations from that subcommittee. One is that the pilot should be conducted system-wide. Because we don't want in the north to pay more than our friends down south for services. That's something that's key in King County, the regional equity. And then the second part is that Houghton should be closed during any pilot to make it as real world as humanly possible. We're not going to learn anything unless that station is closed. The strategies that we recommended is one is online wait time information. People can go online and check, look at the queues, see how long it's going to take for them from the time they arrive to the time they leave the station, extending operating hours, a higher minimum fee to reduce some self-haul, incentive peak pricing. I call this the blue light special, perhaps a lower rate at 8 p.m. as opposed to 2 in the afternoon, and some unloading assistance. There were some other strategies that were ruled out, like more bulky collection curbside contracts manage that, and it's hard for them to enforce that, as well as, for instance, mandatory garbage like we have in Kirkland. It's going to be really hard in a pilot to force other cities to do that. So we ruled out some of those. In terms of where we are right now, the King County Solid Waste Division has not committed to closing the Houghton Transfer Station. We've been very vocal in asking for that, and we will continue to be. The scope of the pilot has actually been reduced from the entire county to just the Northeast County. The original budget was $4 million. They reduced it down to $2 million. And frankly, we're not really sure what we're getting for our money for that $2 million. We have not seen a budget for how they're going to spend that money and actually make it a pilot that we learn something from. As Council Member and Chair, MISWAC Chair Sweet, can attest, at the last September MISWAC meeting, there was several cities were quite vocal, and these are some of the comments that we heard. There's still a lack of equity in the system. There's a lot of transportation impacts. Bellevue brought up the fact that they have a conditional use permit for the Factoria transfer station, which has a threshold for the number of trips to the station, and that this could be exceeded during a pilot or the non-existence of Houghton. And so they said that they could, if they wished, revoke that permit, which could be an issue as well. There was also an issue of incentive pricing, potentially driving revenues in the King County system to the Snohomish County system in the Northeast, as well as really just a general consensus, it seemed to me, that the county at this point doesn't seem to be really listening as much as they should to their member cities. And so these are some actions that we'd like to run by the City Council tonight. The first is authorizing a letter to the county reiterating our desire to close Houghton, as well as close it during the pilot and close it by 2021. Also authorizing a delegation to meet with King County Council members Balducci and Dembowski, as well as reach out to Chair McDermott, and then authorize staff to look at other opportunities with our neighboring partners. In fact, we have a meeting with the City of Bellevue this Friday to talk with them to see where our interests align. And then also engage with King County to see if there are any opportunities for a station in Kirkland somewhere else. And then we do have the comprehensive plan process coming up. We thought we had it in 2009, but we had a lot of issues come up, so we're revisiting that here very soon. And so we would want something in that comprehensive plan that gives a date certain for the closure of Houghton. And so the council will have the opportunity to approve or disapprove of that plan. So that's another opportunity for us to weigh in. So, and with that, questions and discussion.
Thank you. Ms. Kloba?
Yeah, back, I think, two slides. Maybe it's only one on this slide here. One of the unaddressed issues, and maybe it's sort of considered in that traffic impacts, but it's not just, you know, the increased miles traveled or whatever, but I would really like to see some effort to come up with what is sort of the average carbon greenhouse gas emission footprint of that. Because if we are driving, the closures shows that people are ending up having to drive further. It's not just a customer impact. It's a greater system impact on all of us. And I think that an increase in greenhouse gas emissions would certainly be something that is against the goals that King County and the region have. So I'd really like to see those negative externalities in the study.
Okay.
Comments, Ms. Sweet?
I just sort of follow up on that comment because I know the issue for the haulers is a very big one. I believe Republic uses Houghton very heavily.
They all do. They all do. Okay. Yeah.
So it would be a sort of rerouting of all the trucks that are currently using the Houghton land or the Houghton transfer station.
Yes. And then sort of piggybacking on that, it's one thing when we're talking about the trucks that, you know, Recology and Waste Management, those guys use, which often are a compressed natural gas or something that's a little more green. But when we're talking about the self-haulers and how would this impact them, those are generally a lot of trips. Certainly, it's a better impact if we can change the self-haul versus the professional haulers to consolidate trips, essentially. So
how can we be helpful here tonight? Do you want to write a letter? Do you
if John could go back to the recommendations, would
please
just be, I think the most formal action we need is that you give a motion to authorize a letter, which we haven't drafted yet, that we'd bring back for approval that would go to the council, the King County Council, and then again, to authorize some of your membership to go meet with the King County Council members to talk about some of our interests. And then if there's any other concerns you have with these other actions, but those are things that we can do as staff.
Ms. Sweet?
I think one of the concerns that Bellevue has in particular is that Council Member Balducci really hasn't been brought up to speed on this issue yet. And we would really like, I mean, this is all going to hit in her district. I mean, much of the impact of the demand management study in the Northeast, it's telephones are going to ring. So we really need to make sure that they're very clearly aware of what our concerns are. I think John mentioned this is not a quiet table. The last MISWAC meeting, I would suggest that 80% of the people in the room, and it's a large group of people, are sort of aghast at the sense that we're limiting this demand management study. Essentially, I think if we limit it too much, there's no reason to spend the $2 million.
Yeah.
And then there is also the fact that currently SWAC, which is the Solid Waste Advisory Council
Committee,
is really taking more of a position that they don't believe we should do the demand management strategies. They believe that we should simply move forward with siting a new Northeast station, with the sense that we know we're going to need it.
So. Who has the good sense of suggesting that?
Gene Garber.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah. So
I've always liked Gene.
So we have lots of conversation that's going to be happening over the course of the next couple of weeks, but I think getting the council members together with us and certainly reaffirming all of the letters that were in your packet once again would be a useful thing to do.
Mr. Asher and Mr. Nixon.
What's magic about 2021?
That's the latest date that they provided to us, frankly. When you start doing the math on this, siting processes can be very contentious, especially trying to find a site in the Northeast County in particular. So you're talking probably 3 years from now and plus construction. So I think the 2021 is a very optimistic date, frankly. So it could be even further beyond that at this point. So there's no real magic to that. It's been pushed from 2016 to 2018 to 2021 and even I've heard 2023. So
Mr. Nixon?
Yeah, a couple of things. First, on the collaboration with neighboring cities, we do talk to a lot of our fellow council members in other cities, and I'm curious as to what you have in mind in the way of opportunities for collaboration. Knowing, for example, that Redmond and Woodinville have been actively opposing creation of a new Northeast transfer station.
Well, I think, first, our interests are aligned with, for instance, the city of Bothell, the city of Bellevue, the city of Lake Forest Park, who doesn't want that traffic rolling through their city. And so, you know, it's more of speaking all together with one voice might have a little bit more of an impact on trying to get our interests. But, you know, it's interesting with the cities of Woodinville and of Redmond. The city of Woodinville has come out and basically said that they have a couple of major regional facilities in their city, and they don't necessarily want another one. They have the Cascade Recycling Center and Brightwater. The city of Redmond actually has said that you know, they're opposing this basically on the grounds of cost of a new station. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know where we're going to get any traction with them at all. But I think we can definitely get some traction with some of our neighbors that have similar interests.
So it seems like the next point would be one way to lessen Woodinville's opposition is if we could identify a
right.
potential site in Kirkland. Unfortunately, the very nice large site that we had identified for another facility seems to have been scarfed up already for something else. But there was another site that the county had at one time proposed for a jail up in Totem Lake. Had previously been used by waste management to park their trucks at night. Do we know if that site is still available and if it would be large enough?
I don't know about availability, but I can speak to whether it would be suitable for a transfer station. That was one of the locations that when I asked King County to run their transfer station filter mm-hmm. and look at various sites in Kirkland to see if there was anything at all out there, and that was actually one of the viable locations. It wouldn't be on one parcel. It would be actually a combination of, I believe, the three parcels. But I can't speak to the availability, but it was one that they were actually interested in.
Okay.
Ms. Sweet?
I think one of the other things that we need to consider, though, is the county kind of has this one mindset around transfer stations. And there are a number of us who are thinking that you know, one size doesn't necessarily fit all. So maybe what we can create is something that's not nearly as large. Bellevue's concern is that they're going to be way over transfer stationed when they are done with the recycling location and just will never have the capacity for it.
Well, it seems as if we should jump on this right away. So I think that I need a motion to authorize the staff to send a letter to the King County Council reiterating our desire to close the Houghton Transfer Station during the DMS pilot and close the Houghton Transfer Station by 2021.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. It was moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to send authorize a letter from the council. Any further discussion? Yes, sir. Mr. Asher,
I think
Mr.
we need to add this to the Public Works Parks Committee because I think we need to get creative in what actions we take going forward because it seems like it's going to take some action from us to make anything happen.
So you mean add the topic to the the transfer stations to the Public Works and Parks Committee?
Supportive of that?
I'd reframe it as the closure of the Houghton transfer station.
Okay.
Sounds like the council's supportive of that. Mr. Nixon.
So I'm curious why, turn the microphone on. I'm curious why we would limit this motion to just the letter when there's five recommendations here. Are we thinking that the letter requires a motion but the other four don't?
Generally, yeah. Yes.
You think that's the case?
But you could certainly include them all in the motion.
Yeah, I think that many of these things the staff can pursue without a motion. So I personally would encourage that to be done. But I'd be supportive of the motion to authorize the letter if indeed it needs that.
All right. It was moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to authorize a letter from the City Council to the King County Council reiterating our desire to close Houghton during the pilot and close the station by 2021. Will all those in favor please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed say no. Thank you very much. And I think it is the council's desire that you pursue the other bullets as well. Thank you very much for a great presentation, as always, John.
Thank you.
The next item on our agenda is the consent calendar. Before we have a motion, I'll ask Deputy Mayor Arnold to present the audit of the accounts.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. We had payroll in the amount of $3,004,251.55 and bills in the amount of $4,101,682.09.
Thank you. Mr. Asher.
Madam Mayor, I move first to the final reading of the consent calendar.
Second.
It's moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Kloba to approve the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? There is an ordinance, so I'm going to ask Ms. Anderson to call the roll.
Councilmember Nixon?
Aye.
Councilmember Kloba?
Aye.
Councilmember Asher?
Yes.
Councilmember Sweet?
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Wallen?
Yes. Thank you very much. The consent calendar is approved. We're going to move right on to unfinished business. It's Resolution 5210 to eliminate cross subsidies between customer classes of water, sewer, and solid waste utilities no later than the end of the 2022 biennium. City Manager.
Thank you, Madam Mayor, members of the council. So we don't have a formal presentation on this, but I'd like to say that we have been reducing the cross subsidies in the last two rate recommendations, and the council asked us to bring a formal policy setting a target date. The target date of 2021-22 is essentially just maintaining the same pace of reducing the cross subsidy. The other element you'll see in the resolution is that we did give the council sort of a pressure relief valve. So if some major regional pass-through happens through Cascade Water or through King County Metro or the Solid Waste Division, then the council could reset the date so that there wasn't an unnecessary impact on a specific rate. So, but other than that, then you would be setting 2021-22 as the time in which you'd like to see the cross-subsidy essentially eliminated. We're happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for our staff? Entertain a motion to approve Resolution 5210.
So moved.
Thank you. Moved by Councilmember, moved by Deputy Mayor Arnold and seconded by Councilmember Asher. Any discussion? Will all those in favor of approving Resolution 5210 please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed say no. Thank you. Resolution 5210 is approved. Item 10B in unfinished business is Resolution 5211 approving the Cross Kirkland Corridor Art Integration Plan. Good evening, Billy.
Hi. Good evening.
City Manager.
All right. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So we, sort of the interest of efficiency, all of the next three items are related. So the way we wanted to do this is have one presentation that covers all three items, but then have the council take them in order. And so here to give you that presentation is Philly Marsh, our Special Projects Coordinator, and then also Ellen Miller-Wolf, our Economic Development Manager. So Philly, take it away.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. So the three
topics we're going to discuss today is the Cross Kirkland Corridor Art Integration Plan, the Public Art Guidelines, we have an additional section we'd like to add, and the 1% for Public Art Policy Guidelines. So starting with the Cross Kirkland Corridor Art Integration Plan, we brought this to you back in July, and it was requested that we conduct some additional outreach. So we did do that, and we it was great to hear additional comments that are reflective and supportive of what is outlined in the plan. And we did add those comments as an appendix to the plan and are here to present it and get final approval.
So are you going to go through all three before? I think.
Oh, we're going through all three. Okay, so that's number one.
I would say, too, that none of the comments changed any of the framework of the plan, so we're recommending just adopting the framework that was presented to the council last time.
Great. So the second one is the public art guidelines, and we did bring a comprehensive update to you back in 2015 last year. The guidelines hadn't been updated in over 10 years, so we did a big comprehensive update, and we want to make sure we do stay current with these guidelines. So since that update, the Cross Kirkland Corridor Art Integration Plan has outlined how ephemeral art can be activated on the Cross Kirkland Corridor. So we did add this to the guidelines. It reflects what's already in there under temporary art exhibits, and there's a section of the Park Lane Sculpture Gallery. So it's consistent with that, and we just wanted to add that in so we can continue to move forward and use that as a policy document. And then last, but definitely not least, is the 1% for public art policy guidelines. So our capital improvement program does include a 1% for art policy, but we don't currently have a 1% for art policy guidelines. So it's just a very small section in the capital improvement program that we've been going off of. So these guidelines were developed by a working group that consisted of staff and department leadership from affected departments. And we developed these over about an 8-month period, 7 working sessions, because we really wanted to be thoughtful about the process and make sure that we were reflecting both past and current public art projects and getting all those lessons learned in the document. So, kind of just
question
a,
for you.
Sure.
Ms. Rush.
Thank you. I wonder if we might approve the first two resolutions. I'd like to discuss the third resolution in detail.
Dig into it a little bit more.
If that would be, and I'd rather us not lose the first two.
Mm-hmm.
If that's acceptable, then I would move resolution 5211, approving the Cross Kirkland Corridor Art Integration Plan.
Thank you. It's moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to approve Resolution 5211, approving the Cross Kirkland Corridor Art Integration Plan. Any discussion? Ms. Kloba.
I think I see incorporated into the document, if I'm reading this right. Actually, let me back up a notch. This is the one that is our... I need to find the top of it. The art policy guidelines.
Right.
There was, we included ephemeral art, but then at the very end of the document, we talk about public input. And originally, we talked about decisions to acquire and cite public art, but also approving temporary or ephemeral. And is that already reflected?
It is not.
Here. Okay.
Could just maybe make a oral amendment to add that word.
Yeah. I just felt like we had discussed ephemeral art earlier in the document, and then it wasn't quite reflected there, because there is a possibility that we might want to have some public input on some piece of ephemeral art performance or some type. So I just wanted to be able to include that in there.
So you have an amendment?
So I would amend on e-page 502, the bullet point that starts with after City Council receives the recommendation from the Arts Commission, the third sentence to be amended so that it includes, so it would read, the recommendation before making a decision to acquire and cite public art, including ephemeral art. And then the rest is to approve temporary memorial art or deaccession art.
So just a clarification, the ephemeral art is under the temporary art section, so we can add that.
Okay.
But it is included.
All right.
So small, I think the current motion you're looking at is for the first is B, Resolution 5211, which is the art integration plan. I think the changes you're suggesting, Councilor Clove, would be the second one, which is the 5212, the ephemeral art plan.
Gotcha. And that would just, okay.
So you might want to just hold that thought till the next resolution.
So we do have a motion on the floor, but I can let it expire without a second, correct?
It's been seconded.
It's been seconded?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. It was moved by Councilmember Clova and seconded by, apologies.
No, that was the motion to amend.
The motion to amend.
That was the motion to amend died for lack of a second.
Okay, correct. Thank you. Okay, so the question is on the main motion, which was moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Sweet, to approve the Cross Kirkland Corridor Art Integration Plan, Resolution 5211. Will all those in favor please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed say no. Thank you. Resolution 5211 is approved. And now we're on to Resolution 5212 relating to ephemeral art. And this is where I think, yes, Mr. Asher.
I'll put it before us. Okay. Madam Mayor, I'd like to move Resolution 5212 relating to adding ephemeral art to the Cross Kirkland Corridor to the city's public art policy guidelines.
Thank you. Thank you. Moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Deputy Mayor Arnold to approve Resolution 5212. And Ms. Kloba, did you want to add some language here?
You know, now that I am reading through it, given that temporary is also included, because there's a different paragraph further on or before in the packet where it calls out ephemeral art, visual or performance art, sort of in a different way. So I just wanted to, I appreciate that it's in there.
Highlight.
And for some reason, when I read it Monday night, it didn't jump out at me. So thank you.
Okay. So the opportunity is there for public input on public art opportunities, including ephemeral art. Okay. Any further discussion on Resolution 5212 and the motion before us? It was moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Deputy Mayor Arnold to approve Resolution 5212 relating to adding ephemeral art on the Cross Kirkland Corridor to the city's public art policy guidelines. Will all those in favor please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. And those opposed say no. Thank you. Resolution 5212 is approved. Now, Resolution 5213, adopting the 1% for public art policy guidelines. Do you have more to present to us?
Well, I just wanted to give you a brief summary of what all is included in the document. So we defined projects with 1% art eligibility and outlined the process for including the 1% for art in the project timeline and budget, so all parties that have hands in the project are aware of it and are communicating clearly. The approval process for the 1% for public art, how it goes through different committees and stakeholder groups. And then some guidelines for art inclusion in both design projects as well as construction projects of various sizes and budgets. And then we did add the opportunity to pool funding for small projects and some that are in similar categories, such as the sidewalk projects and Cross Kirkland Corridor projects. And then also did touch on maintenance considerations for managing the 1% for public art installations. So that's a summary of what all is included, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Philly. Yes, sir. Mr. Asher.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I really am glad to see this. Thanks for putting form around something that has sort of been, I guess, without form for quite a long time. I would like to open it up a little bit. From where we have a proposal to make pooling as normal as calculating the amounts, so that when we have even small projects, and this takes the sizable projects, and says okay, you have to be this big to even qualify. I'm one that comes from a generation where nickels and dimes add up, and they can end up doing some good things. So I'd like us to use as large a sweep as possible for being able to contribute to the 1% for the arts. I understand that there's some accounting that may need to take place for things that capital projects that are funded by utilities. It has to have a nexus with the utility of things. But I think that accounting's well within our capability of being able to do. But on a general theme, I went over with the city manager today that if we could use the opportunity to take sort of a different slant to make as much 1% money available as possible. And I understand that there's grants that won't allow that, and that's fine. There's other funding sources that won't allow that. That's fine. But building up the 1% where we can, I'd like to use the opportunity. I think it gives us a nice addition that we can enhance across broader parts of the city. There, I have some specifics, but I can give you those at a later time.
So you have some specific changes to the guidelines that you'd like to propose. So you think maybe this isn't ready for us to act tonight?
If we want to broaden to allow more to be able to be contributed for public art. No, I don't think it is. Mm-hmm. And I think that it didn't seem that there's any structural requirements for us to not do that.
No deadlines we will miss or important?
There's certainly no particular deadlines. We do have the big capital projects list that you're going to approve later this year. So we certainly want this in place as soon as we can, but there's no specific deadline. So one option is you could refer this to like the Public Works and Parks Committee for action. In other words, you could adopt this now and still refer it and bring back amendments. I think the council could do either one, but there is no particular deadline.
I don't think it needs to be that much. I don't even think it needs to be referred to committee. If we express sort of an interest that let's catch more small donations for the arts, I think that we can probably be restaffed here maybe for the next meeting. I can't anticipate the workload or whatever, but I don't think it's not a big structural change.
Mr. Arnold?
I'm wondering, Mr. Asher, if you could characterize the change. Are you looking at dropping the threshold and therefore generating more,
right,
more 1%?
Yes. Essentially taking out the categorizations and saying that things might be, and we just say, okay, if it's a capital project that meets the criteria, then we're going to include the 1%, whether it's $2.43 or whether it's $243,000.
So I wonder if it would be within our staff's ability to make these changes and have it ready for us at the next meeting. Do you think that's possible?
I think we could have a proposal, whether mm-hmm. it actually meets the need. We'd probably have to get a little more clarity. Mm-hmm. So,
and be glad to sit down and talk that through.
We okay with that?
But I think one of the things we just want to make sure we would also do is be evaluating those potential legal issues of, you know, the Accountancy Act and making sure that anything
Absolutely.
We do, 1%, is, you know, appropriately used as basis of the fund that it comes from.
Yeah.
So that was what some of the analysis went into for this. So. But we could develop some options to bring back for the council next week or the next council meeting.
Super.
Are you okay with that? I just don't want to miss any big projects coming along. Yes, Mr. Nixon, I think we're okay.
So do we need a formal motion to postpone?
Well, I would ask you that question, sir.
I would ask him that question.
You suggesting a motion to table, Councilmember Nixon?
Well, to postpone to the next meeting as opposed to tabling for within this meeting.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
It's okay. On the agenda. Do we have to do that?
You sure can, and it would be just a majority vote of those present.
Okay.
I'm not sure if we would want to tie the staff to the mm-hmm. next meeting turn-in time.
You.
Let's just. okay. I would mm-hmm. move to table resolution 5213.
Thank you. That would be helpful.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Nixon to table Resolution 5213. And I do need a majority of the members to vote. Is that correct, Mr.?
Majority of those Ray. Present.
Thank you so much. Will all those in favor please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed say no. Thank you very much, and thank you for your attention.
Thanks for your
look forward to having it back. Okay, the next item on our agenda, and how are we doing? We're okay for... Oh, yes, we're okay. All right, the next item on our agenda then is item 11, new business. It's the proposed draft 2017 state legislative priorities agenda. Ms. McKay, good evening. Mr. Triplett.
All right, thank you, Madam Mayor. So this is your first crack at the state legislative agenda. We're looking for feedback, comments, changes, and then we'll be bringing this back later this year for final adoption. And here to walk you through the draft agenda and how we got it is our Government Relations Manager, Laurie McKay.
Thank you, City Manager. Good evening, Madam Mayor, Deputy Mayor, Council, for the record. I'm Laurie McKay, your Government Relations Manager. As just mentioned, tonight we're discussing the draft 2017 legislative priorities. We're seeking your comments and feedback on this draft so we can prepare final priorities at your next council meeting on the 18th. I'm going to begin the presentation by summarizing the process of developing the city's legislative agenda. I'll then outline some additional steps and milestones in this process, and I'll also do an overview of the proposed draft principles and legislative priorities, and then I'll also touch on some issues still under consideration, and then we'll end with feedback unless you ask questions along the way. If I can get this going. Okay, so just as a reminder, the legislative priorities represent the highest priority items on the city's legislative agenda, and they are the primary focus during session. These draft priorities were developed over a four-month process. In June, staff reached out to the department directors and managers to solicit ideas for the legislative session coming up. Council's legislative work group, chaired by Councilmember Asher and includes Mayor Wallen and Councilmember Marchioni, that group generally participates in the Association of Washington City's efforts to develop their legislative priorities, which are a set of state priorities. Both members, Asher and Mayor Wallen, participate on the AWC's legislative committee. That committee met in August. And it met again in September, and then just late last week developed or adopted the 2017 AWC legislative priorities. At the same time, other council members are participating in various stakeholder groups. Councilmember Nixon, for example, has been participating in a Public Records Act stakeholder group. City manager has been participating in some housing and homelessness stakeholder groups. And myself, the government relations manager, I've been participating in some large cities discussions and stakeholder groups. The council's legislative work group convened in September to look at all of the various information that has been gathered and identify core issues and priorities to recommend for council's consideration tonight. The 2017 session is a long session. It's 105 days, and word on the street, it's likely to go longer, but we'll see when we get there. The April 21st is when the 105-day session should officially end, basically because lawmakers and the governor are still faced with huge McCleary challenges. About $3.5 billion every 2 years in just school salaries alone. That's why folks are suggesting that the session's going to be extended, and that is also why staff and the legislative work group are recommending a pretty modest and tempered legislative agenda for 2017. Whoops. This slide shows some additional steps and milestones in the process. Again, we'd like to come back on the 18th of October with a final draft or a final set of priorities. We're hoping to kick off our legislative coffees or legislative breakfasts in November and December. Session begins January 9th and concludes on April 21st. The cutoff calendar for the session is finalized on the first day of session. Staff will provide a legislative support items agenda for council review and consideration in January, and then we'll provide regular updates throughout the session. As a reminder, Kirkland's legislative agenda includes three segments: general principles, legislative priorities, and then the legislative support items, again, which we'll bring back to you in January. This slide shows the general principles that are they're intended to guide and focus our activities throughout the legislative session. These have been carried over from last year's legislative agenda. There are no proposed changes to the legislative or to the general principles, so I'll just quickly touch on them. They are to protect shared state revenues, including the state annexation sales tax credit, support long-term sustainability efforts and financial, environmental, and transportation goals, oppose unfunded mandates, and oppose any further shifting in cost or services from the state or county to cities. So this is basically the guts of what we're here to talk about tonight, the draft priorities. They're found on page 515 of your packet. There are six priorities recommended. They are that Kirkland supports new funding and policy tools to build affordable housing, such as restore the housing trust fund to pre-recession levels, add affordable housing to the list of eligible projects that can be funded by REIT 1 and REIT 2, and extend the document recording fee for housing, eliminate the sunset, and increase the fee. This theme is carried over from last session's legislative agenda, but this three specific bullets are new bullets to going into 2017. The next bullet is to allow Kingsgate Park and Ride to be used for affordable housing or affordable housing at a transit-oriented development. This is new to this year's agenda. The next one is to provide adequate and sustainable funding to maintain statewide training for law enforcement personnel. This is also new. And then the next is to allow jurisdictions the option to cap an MPD, a Metropolitan Park District. The next one is to support capital transportation budget funding for the multimodal safety improvement project connecting the CKC with the Redmond Central Corridor or Connector. This is carried over from last year, from 2016. And then finally, allow both state and local governments the option of replacing the property tax cap, currently fixed at 1%, with a cap that is indexed to both population growth and inflation. This is carried over from 2015 and also carried over from 2016. So 3 years carrying forward this priority. And then finally, this is topic that's still under consideration and discussion. This slide is included to highlight the potential of including proposed changes to the Public Records Act and to seek council direction on whether such proposals should be added to the priority agenda. The three potential proposed changes being discussed are to exempt non-appointed volunteers from the act, to establish a charge for electronic records, basically bring the act into the 21st century, and then three, to create a path to predictability on fines. So that's the quick overview, and I'm here to take comments, questions, feedback.
Yes, sir. Mr. Asher, then Mr. Nixon. Thank you, Lori.
The keys are short and focused.
Right.
because money is going to be little for anything else other than McCleary this year. The one thing I would, and it's just on the later reading, I would sort of rephrase the Metropolitan Park District one to change to cap to set a lower taxing limit for, and that I think clarifies it so you can read it pretty much on its face and understand that. The Open Public Record Act change for volunteers, I think, is an important one. And Mr. Nixon has informed me that the Department of Enterprise Services is already circulating a bill for comment out there. So we can get behind something that's got some form to it. The other aspects of the Open Public Records Act, I don't know if we might be able to put an expression to them, but I don't know if we have language or form right now to be able to articulate those.
Mr. Nixon.
Yeah, so I can talk a little bit to that, being a participant in this PRA stakeholder group that was convened by our former mayor. And former Mayor Larry Springer is also a member of that group and many other folks. It's about 45 people.
Jeez.
There are... there are a few things that the group is converging on, and one of them is this idea of a nominal charge for the base cost of processing a request, and also a small per record charge for electronic records. And the idea here would be to discourage people from making arbitrarily large requests because they're perceived as being free. Mm-hmm. And even the requester community is in favor of that. The newspapers and LexisNexis and others have all said they'd be willing to pay a nominal charge in order to get the benefit of encouraging people to focus their requests on exactly what they want and not request all of an agency's records and those kind of things. The other thing that it's being discussed is defining what customized access is. This is kind of a term that's used in the Attorney General's model rules, but it's not defined. But essentially, it would make it easier for agencies like the city to be able to charge for IT work that's necessary to extract records from databases and those kind of things that are not part of the routine day-to-day work of the employees of the agency. So you wouldn't be able to charge if you can get at the records just through your normal everyday tools. But if you had to write something, create some tool in order to extract the records, then you would be able to charge for the actual time involved in doing that work. And so that would help with cost recovery as well. There's still discussion about things like alternative dispute resolution, but that's going to be hard to get traction on this year because of the potential cost of that. We're looking again at best practices around the country, what other states do along those lines for models, and trying to find something that would discourage people or encourage people not to take cases to court, but to resolve them outside of the court system. And there's a few other things we're discussing, but that gives you an idea of where some consensus legislation might come together. The predictability of fines, there has been talk about capping PRA fines or those kind of things. That would be very hard to get a consensus agreement on, but we'll see. So just so everybody knows, from a timing perspective, right now the stakeholder group is in the process of putting together kind of the bullet points of what this consensus legislation would be. Some of the legislative members of the stakeholder group are kind of rushing ahead and drafting bill language, but we haven't yet reached agreement even on the bullet points. But I think the next meeting, of the stakeholder group is the middle of this month. We should have a hopefully be able to come out of that with an agreement on what high-level points we can include in the legislation. And then the goal would be to have the legislation drafted certainly by the end of November. Now, that's going to be a little late for us to talk to our legislators about it specifically. And I would not want us to take a position where we're just going to say we're going to blanket agree with whatever it is that comes out of this process. But I think it's likely that once we get a chance to look at it, that we will be able to agree to it.
Yes, sir.
Well, what we're working on here, the vehicle that we're talking about, is just what would we like to see implemented in whatever form can be ultimately agreed to, is what's in our interest. And right. I think that the three topics here, as they're expressed, would be satisfactory to say this is ripe for the legislative agenda. It may not be ripe for a circulating a bill,
right?
To go that so,
sure.
So I would recommend adding these three under a Public Records Act priority. Is that the best way to express that?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
So adding another priority.
Yeah.
Yep.
And give us seven, lucky seven.
Lucky seven. Mr. Arnold.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I appreciate the work that the committee and staff has done on this. I support these priorities, as well as the addition of the Public Records Act as a seventh priority. I wanted to note the priority around allowing local jurisdictions to cap the authority on metropolitan parks districts. Boy, I wish we had the foresight to have done that in the legislative agenda before, but I don't want to make that same mistake again, and I'm wondering if we could ask the legislative committee to take a look at potential public safety ballot measures and see if there's anything in existing law that we might want to change, considering we may be going to the ballot for a public safety ballot measure within the next few years.
We can look at that. I don't think there is another animal quite the same as an MPD. Excuse me, I've never heard of it, but I hadn't heard of an MPD before.
I just want to make sure we're not making that same mistake.
Okay.
Before we get next turn.
Good. Thank you.
Happy to look at that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, other reactions? Are we on the right track if we add the Public Records Act bullets here?
This works.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Madam Mayor, I would move with the addition of the Open Public Records Act. Bullet that we adopt the legislative agenda as presented by the staff.
Second.
Thank you. Moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Sweet, that with the addition of the bullets relating to the Public Records Act, the legislative agenda be adopted as presented by the staff. Discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed, say no. Thank you very much, Lori.
Thank you. There it is,
just like that.
Super.
Excellent. Ahead of the game. Okay. Yes, sir.
Now that we've looked at the legislative agenda, I know the support agenda will be coming up. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of other asks for the committee to look at with the council's approval.
Sure.
One is that within the Growth Management Policy Board, there was a big discussion around conditional certification of Pierce County that is having a big amount of their growth happening in urban unincorporated areas that didn't annex. And through that process, discovered that Pierce County is not eligible for the annexation sales tax credit. And I think that was key to our successful annexation, and it's something that I think is important for growth management. So I would like to have the committee look at whether there is that issue and whether it's something we could add to the support agenda to make sure that the annexation sales tax credit is available throughout the PSRC region.
Are they asking for it?
They will be, or they have been.
Okay.
I don't have a specific bill for you.
Sure, that's cool.
That's going to be interesting. Anything further? That looks good. Thank you.
Thanks.
The next item on our agenda is also under new business. It's Resolution 5214, allocating the city's portion of the Community Development Block Grant funds for 2017. City Manager.
Okay, thank you. So As stated, we're looking for your direction on how to allocate the city's community development block grant funds for 2017. And here to give you the presentation is our Human Services Coordinator, Leslie Miller.
Good evening, Madam Mayor and Council. I'm probably doing this the wrong way, but there we go. So just a quick reminder that the City of Kirkland has been a participant in the King County CDBG and Home Consortium as a joint agreement city since 2015. And as part of that status, that we need to annually allocate funds. And so we had a hearing, the Human Services Advisory Committee had a public hearing on September 19th. And they're making the following recommendations. Capital projects to allocate an estimated $128,533 to ARCH for affordable housing projects. Allocating an estimated $29,892 to Congregations for the Homeless to support a day center and emergency winter shelter for men experiencing homelessness. And then the same amount, $29,892, for Parks and Community Services Department to administer the CDBG program activities.
Thank you. Questions or comments for Leslie? I'd entertain a motion to approve.
Madam Mayor, I'd move Resolution 5214, allocating the city's portion of community development block grant funds for 2017.
Second.
Thank you. It's moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to approve Resolution 5214. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed, say no. Thank you very much. With thanks to the members of our Human Service Advisory Group. Thank you for your advice. The next item on our agenda is Human Services Grant Funding Recommendations for 2017-18. City Manager.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So as you all know, every 2 years when we do our budget, we also allocate the money that the council sets aside for human services funding grants. And we have an extraordinary committee that comes together and goes through extraordinarily thick binders with really challenging choices and spend months coming up with a recommendation, which they are now going to propose to you. The action on approving the final grant amounts actually happens during the budget process, but tonight we want to tell you what the committee recommended, and then they're available for questions or comments or any input. So to start that process is once again Leslie Miller.
Thank you again, Madam Mayor and Council. So I just want to first off introduce our committee members, which we have six of the seven present tonight. Kimberly Scott is our chair. Margaret Schwender is the vice chair. And then Joanne Gere and Jessica Wells, our youth member, and Ann Radcliffe and Pat Swanson in the back.
Thank you for your service and thank you for being here tonight. It means a lot to us.
So before I go ahead and make the presentation, the chair, Kimberly Scott, has a few words to say, to introduce things.
I wrote them down because there's more than a few and I want to stay on track for you, so sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you, council members, for allowing me the opportunity to address you. I wanted to go over just a few things before Leslie actually gives a presentation on our recommendations. But first, I want to acknowledge a couple things. I'd like to thank you, the city, for increasing the number of committee members this year. It's been very helpful to have all of the different perspectives, and I want to thank them very much for showing up tonight. They did a lot of work this summer. The committee would also like to acknowledge the overall increased funding from the city since 2009. However, we want to note that since 2009, Kirkland has almost doubled in its population, and the funding has not kept pace. Although a large portion of the growth was due to annexation, Kirkland is still growing faster than most of the east side cities. And with that growth, we've seen a large change in demographics and in diversity. If I could just read this, it'd be better, but I tell you, I need reading glasses too. My apologies. The committee members attended meetings with surrounding cities and looked at statistical information that help us get a better understanding of what those changing needs are in our city. We found some interesting facts. We found that the city of Kirkland, that the population of people between the ages of 15 and 64 by percentage is actually shrinking. That's considered our workforce population to bring in our income. We also discovered that, of course, the under 15 age group and the over 64 age group are increasing in our population. These two segments, youth and seniors, are often very vulnerable. Seniors, in fact, face unique challenges. Many are on fixed incomes and face age-based disabilities. They can easily fall from self-sufficient to dependent with one emergency. The committee is also aware that certain federal and local funding sources have changed focus and less funding is available for youth and senior programs. This made funding choices in these areas more important to the committee. We also would like to acknowledge that the East Side as a whole is a very diverse community. Statistics show that Bellevue schools are reporting a minority-majority enrollment. Although Kirkland is less diverse than Bellevue, in certain areas of our city, up to 23% of the households speak a language other than English, and over 117 languages are reported to be spoken in the Lake Washington School District. We know that language and cultural differences can create isolation. I was excited to hear from Mayor Wallen just a few weeks ago at an event about Eastside Welcoming Week. We know that it was a step to decrease isolation and welcome diversity in our cities, and there were some really wonderful grants this year to kind of help along with that process. We also discovered that Kirkland has over 4,000 veterans living in our city. It's the second largest veteran population on the East Side. And we know as a group that veterans tend to have a higher percentage of disabilities with about 25% of their population versus about 9.7% of the regular population. And of course, unemployment rates are substantially higher for those with disabilities. We also then looked at unemployment rates. We found that although getting better, Kirkland still showed higher unemployment rates than Bellevue, Issaquah, and Redmond, and that over 20% of Kirkland residents are served by DSHS in some fashion. Considering that they say the living wage for a single adult on the East Side is $16.13 per hour, which is far above the minimum wage, you can see where even dual-income families may need services. There was a substantial increase in the requests this funding cycle, and as outcomes of requests, we've noted that Bellevue and Issaquah have both increased their funding levels to address homelessness, and that the City of Redmond has increased their funding levels to address issues identified by their commission's task force. And while the committee understands that there are many places and ways to invest in our city, we would like to ask that you consider increasing the investment in the citizens already living here and needing help. We feel if we can keep people living here, they're more likely to spend money here, thus giving back to the tax base and overall enriching the cultural diversity of our city. And now I'll give it back over to Leslie to present the findings that we had from our committee and our recommendations.
Thank you very much for speaking tonight.
So the committee deliberations began with a lot of independent reading. As was suggested, they each received binders of all the applications, and they did read all of them, and they utilized a reading tool that was part that led to some of the conversation, as well as Kimberly suggested a focus on the community needs and as have changed over time. Just a reminder that we divide up all of the applications into 5 goal areas: food to eat and roof overhead, supportive relationships within families, neighborhoods, and communities, safe haven from all forms of violence and abuse, health care to be as physically and mentally fit as possible, and education and job skills to lead an independent life. Whoops. And just that these are a couple of the slides that will be in your budget issue paper that will be in your larger budget packet, but these are the total amount, as Kimberly noted, has been going up over time, and versus kind of our per capita spending, which has not ever reached back to pre-annexation of 2011. And so you'll see that $11.77 in just a minute in their recommendations. So they did receive 81 program applications from 51 agencies, and the funding request totaled over $1.4 million for each year. So there were 3 options. The base budget funding, the second option would be to maintain the funding that is being distributed this year in 2016, and the third option, if possible, is to increase program funding up to $1,177 per capita. So option one is a total of $731,650, and this comes from general fund of $701,758, and then the CDBG dollars as well. And this is an increase in the 2015-2016 base budget, but with additional investments that you have made over the last couple of years, it is actually a net decrease. And this option is not recommended by the Human Services Advisory Committee. As you will note from your packet, there were a number of programs.
Question for you, Mr. Asher.
Just back on the slide with option one, where you say it's a net decrease. It's a net decrease from the permanent funding and the one-time funding.
Correct.
Is that correct? Okay.
Yes.
Just to make sure. All right. Thank you.
So while there were a lot of really tough choices, and the reason why the Human Services Advisory Committee does not recommend option one is because a number of programs were defunded in this process, but we wanted to highlight a few programs that were added that they feel so strongly about. And as we know, we're in the midst of a state of emergency of homeless crisis, and there's some opportunities to fund some new programs that address both programs for those in the midst of homelessness as well as housing opportunities. So Catholic Community Services, in hopefully within less than 2 weeks, will be opening their new Bethlehem Day Center for families at the Salt House in Kirkland. In addition, Friends of Youth is asking for homeless youth outreach and drop-in support for the first time. This program had been traditionally been funded by the federal government, and that funding went away. And so they're asking cities to assist funding that program. And then finally, as we know, Imagine Housing just broke ground on Athene, their new housing project for older adults, and they are asking for dollars to provide support to residents.
The homeless youth outreach program, is that the one in Redmond?
Yes, part of it, the drop-in support is, they actually, in addition to that, they have a mobile outreach unit. So it's not just all happening at the landing. But yes, the drop-in work is definitely at the landing. So in addition to Athene, they've also had Kirkland Plaza that they've had here for a number of years with older adults, and they want to be able to offer supportive services to those folks as well. So option two is what is being spent this year, which is $786,623 from the general fund, and then the $29,892 in CDBG funding, for a total of $816,515. The program highlight here is a new program that it's not new, but it's new to for funding for the city of Kirkland, and that is an organization called Prevail that offers employment supports to youth with disabilities. And we are really struck by the success that they have had. As you'll note here, without employment supports, only 16% of people with disabilities are employed in the state. And with the help of supported employment agencies in King County, up to 65% successfully are employed, and Prevail has had a job placement success rate of 85%. So they're very excited about this new program that goes in, that go into the school districts like Washington School District and work with young people. The third option is to increase funding from the general fund up to $966,792. And then that combined with the CDBG funding would reach that pre-annexation level of $11.77 per capita. And there is an extensive list that is outlined, but we just wanted to highlight one of the new programs. This would be the first priority that for additional funding that the Human Services Advisory Committee has identified, and this is an organization called One America and their English Innovations Program. And so this is a program where they would partner up with a school in Kirkland to offer English learning English assistance to parents so that they could be able to participate in their children's school life more extensively. And as Kimberly noted, we have had a doubling, actually, of folks who are born outside of the United States in Kirkland, and over 20% of them are speaking a language other than English at home, and 7.1% of Kirkland residents report speaking English less than very well. And so they're excited about this new program. So I know there are lots of moving parts, so I'm certainly happy to answer any questions. I just didn't want to have too many slides with all the changes that were being proposed. So as Kurt mentioned, the target date is October 20th for the budget, where you'll receive that and then be moving forward during the budget review process.
Thank you very much, Leslie. Mm-hmm. Mr. Nixon.
Thank you. So I appreciate the fact that the committee made the effort to prioritize what's in option three, because we may not be able to fully fund it, but if we partially fund it, we kind of have a sequence, or you know, we could come up with an amount and then draw a line.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The question I have is, what was the prioritization methodology? Did you have a scoring system of some kind? How did you decide that they should be in this order?
Does someone else want to take it, or you want me to? Okay. So they had come up with their kind of talking about community needs as they went along, and then also just did, because there were so many programs, they did some top 10 work as well. And so there's a combination of community needs and particularly seniors. Seniors were a big issue, and then as well as realizing that goal area number 5, which is employment and education support, was lower than the other focus areas. And so they wanted to bump that up. As you can see, do you want to add to that?
Use the mic.
And absolutely, in the matrix when we were going through, the priorities that Leslie talked about were definitely important. When we got to option 3, we were looking at, really, this might be the opportunity to bring in some new programs that could really make a difference. And with the growth of foreign-based residents and issues with speaking the English language, knowing that that causes a lot of difficulties with employment, we thought that that was the best place to start, which is so that there was really a method to our list.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that you did it that way, because a priority for me is looking at unaddressed needs and innovative programs mm-hmm. that can address those. And we've talked from time to time about kind of elevating the committee to be an ongoing human services commission.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I'm hoping that would eventually do is look at those unaddressed needs and look at best practices, solutions that have worked other places, mm-hmm. and actually invite our local agencies to try to implement some of those best practices.
Yes.
So this kind of leans us in that direction, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Are there comments, Ms. Klobuch and Mr. Asher?
So on this priority list, I noticed that the, and I'm pleased to see that the Sound Generations Meals on Wheels mm-hmm. program is, you would see an increase in funding there, and then also Imagine Housing Senior Programs. And I have been concerned, and I've been hearing a lot from seniors about their large worries about the United Way funding having left the building as far as senior services mm-hmm. go, as they're focusing on other things. Are these two in particular areas that used to have some funding? I mean, is this sort of considered some backfilling of that funding that's gone, or is this new? Because I would like to see some replacement of those United Way funds.
So the United Way funding that Sound Generations lost did not cover Meals on Wheels program specifically. However, because there were such substantial cuts that they've been experiencing, not only with United Way, but also in information and referral services they used to have a large contract for, which they lost in the last year, they just haven't had the ability to kind of move, I think, money around as much. And so they have seen a significant increase in the number of people requesting Meals for Wheels. And so they had no way of being able to attack, so to speak, their wait list. And so they came in after the applications were over with and said, we need additional dollars in order to meet that wait list.
Thank you. Ms. Sweet?
I think Mr. Asher was
next. Mr. Asher, then Ms. Sweet. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I'm a bit concerned about stretching a lot of one-time money. Mm-hmm. And it's a concern about reliance and how do we impart to those who are on the margin, so to speak, it doesn't take much more than, a burp for our one-time money to evaporate rather quickly. The annexation sales tax credit program that we've got that will go away in not too many years. We're putting together a program to be able to make up for that, but it may not. So things that are on the cusp, I think, need to be related that they're on the cusp. But that long-term planning is not something that we can assure them, because we'll hear from them, each and every one, next year as they come mm-hmm. and stand where you're standing and say, mm-hmm. but you gave it to us last year. So any way we can do to make their planning more realistic for those that are on the margin, I think is worth at least imparting that, because I've seen organizations make some wrong turns and not be able to recover from mm-hmm. plans that they made. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sweet.
I think that's a really good cautionary comment. At the same time, I'm really glad that we're able to do this. Yes. Potentially and use one-time money in a way that really benefits the community. Mm-hmm. I just want to thank you, Kimberly, for your opening remarks and sort of connecting not just what your process was, but where your hearts were in terms of doing this allocation. It was clearly very thoughtfully done. It's a lot of work, and it's a lot of lines you have to keep in your head. So I want to just thank you guys so very much.
Well said. Ms. Clova. So I'm not sure that there's a succinct answer to this question, but I'm going to throw it out there. So at the All Home meeting, roughly about a month ago, we heard the presentation from Focus Strategies about how really the way that funding for people experiencing homelessness is probably going to change and fairly radically, because it's going to be really based on a performance-based evaluations of the work mm-hmm. that each of the providers are doing in a way to try to get a holistic systemic approach instead of a bunch of individual providers doing great work all by themselves mm-hmm. but not with a good relationship to the whole. And I mean, that came in really after you had done the bulk of your work. So do you see any benefit to holding off on this option 3 additional funding until the dust settles a little bit from that process? Do you think it would change some of what we're interested in funding here, or create new needs that we're not anticipating right now?
I think that the dust will settle in time for the 2019-2020 decisions is probably the best answer. Okay. I think they're rolling out, but we won't see the full effect. And I think you bring up something that's really important, which is kind of a decision that we've actually been having as human services staff, is how do we participate within the system? Do we fund the same way that the large funders decide, or do we support kind of the alternative ways that do not make that aren't funded. For example, you know, one of HopeLink's properties is not going to be in the system. It's going to be outside. They're going to be participating, but in a different way. So do we support programs like that that are supporting the east side, but maybe not in the same way as the larger system? And so that is definitely something that's going to be asked, but I don't think it's something where you can hold off on this process. I really do think it's a longer term, because as they put in those higher outcome requirements, it will probably won't be until 2018 that agencies start losing some funding as well, and then we'll have a better sense of where people are coming out in the process.
Okay, that's very helpful to mm-hmm. understand that timeline better. Thank you.
Any more questions for Leslie?
It might be worth getting some summary information out about the report or maybe even a briefing. I think what we're going to see out of focus strategies is going to be real change on homelessness if the report's followed, and as soon as it can get done and get funded. So I think it'll be worth folks reading and at least raising knowledge levels on.
Great. I agree. And I'll be happy to summarize it. It's 120 pages that you are welcome to read if you would like.
I love your summaries, Leslie. Thank you very much. And thank you for being here. So it's 9:07, and we have the sign code up next. I wonder if we should take a break.
For a couple hours.
Better break. Let's have a 10-minute break. We'll be back in 10. We're back in session after a short break.
It's first odd break.
So very exciting here.
I'll do the first three, and then you can come up. Sure, I think it's three.
And it's about to get even more exciting because Mr. Asher's favorite topic is coming before us. It is item 11D in new business. It's ordinance 4532 in its summary relating to zoning, planning, and land use and amending some chapters of the Kirkland Zoning Code regarding definitions and regulations to ensure content neutrality in sign regulations. City Manager.
All right. Thank you, Madam Mayor, members of the Council. So just a tiny bit of background on this. As you know, the sign code is very complex, as we're going to discuss tonight. And the purpose of tonight's presentation is what we decided was a phase one in our discussions with the Planning Commission Work Program, which was just to address the issue of content neutrality to comply with some Supreme Court decisions. And then what we want to talk about later tonight is come back with another more comprehensive review, which we're calling phase two, which we're looking for some direction on the kinds of things you'd like us to talk about. So, but phase one, our hope is to get this adopted soon because we have a tentative deadline of October 31st from the WCIA. So we're looking for some action or quick discussion. But here to give you an overview of the content neutrality is Dorian Collins from the Planning Department and also Eric LaLiberte, who's our Planning Commission Chair.
Thank you both for being here.
Okay, so tonight we're really here to present the Planning Commission's recommendation for changes to the zoning code, sign regulations. And as was mentioned, it's these findings of recent court decisions that make it advisable for local governments to take a look at their sign regulations and revise them where necessary to ensure that they remain content neutral. And we do have a deadline established of October 31st, end of this month, where we are expected to have made these changes to ensure compliance. So the scope for this study is limited to those changes that are necessary to ensure that sign regulations are content neutral. And we have sent the preliminary amendments to the WCIA in August, and we did receive a response back that the proposed changes looked acceptable. One change that they did suggest was related to the time period for signs related to elections, and that is incorporated into the revised version of page 605 that's on the dais before you. And while some of the zoning code regulations may not appear to be fully content neutral, they are generally minor and unlikely to be challenged. And those are some considerations that were made in discussions. And none of these regulations were flagged by the WCIA or the city attorney. And also, as was mentioned, there will be another opportunity for a broader study of the sign regulations during the next phase, where we expect that to address policy issues and other more general changes. So the process so far has been two study sessions, one before the Planning Commission, one with Houghton Community Council, and then a joint public hearing in September. There was also a briefing with the Kirkland Alliance of Neighborhoods and general public notice provided. There were some comments received, and they generally apply to the issues that would likely be part of phase two. And this slide also mentions that recommended revision to attachment A to the ordinance. And that's eliminating that pre-election restriction on posting political signs, which is also recommended by MRSC, which warns that those kinds of restrictions may be unconstitutional. So now I'd like to introduce Eric LaLiberty, chair of the Planning Commission.
Good evening, members of the council. I'm here to present the Planning Commission's recommendation. The recommendation is based upon only a handful of comments that we received from the community during our public hearing, both written and via oral testimony. We also had a joint meeting with the Houghton Community Council in which we considered the comments and concerns of the Houghton Council. The commission's recommendation, I think everyone on the commission recognizes that the amended ordinance as recommended by the commission is not a perfect ordinance. It is our feeling is the best we can do with the time constraints we had and the need to put something forward that would pass muster with the WCIA. I will say that there are, if you look in the exclusions, we recognize there are some issues that may not be perfectly content neutral. For example, exclusion number 9, regulating signs 2 square feet that are 2 square feet per sign face. We spent over an hour debating just that particular exclusion to give you an idea of how tricky and complicated this issue is. We settled on the language that is recommended in our recommendation, believing that it would, on the basis that it did pass muster with the WCIA and was unlikely, if it is problematic, to be challenged. So I'm happy to take any questions on our recommendation.
Questions for the Planning Commission Chair, Mr. Asher.
Well, I'm happy to see that the WCIA seems to think that these changes are acceptable. That'll take most of what I was planning to say tonight and probably move it to phase two because we are far from content neutrality. And even if you read the Supreme Court case ruling, if WCIA will defend our Blazing Bagels case when we get it, under these circumstances, then I'm pretty much good with it. We can put everything else and stick it into to the next phase. I appreciate the sense of urgency that we had that they won't insure us after a certain date, although we can't seem to find that they've said that. But we'll get that audit somewhere here in the not too distant future. But good job then in making the grade with the agency that matters that holds the big pot of money.
Mr. Arnold,
I too applaud your work in taking the existing framework and it's coming up with language that is content neutral without really changing policy. I think there's going to be some long discussion on phase two, but I really do appreciate the work that happened here. I do have one question on enforcement. This may be a question for Dorian. It looks like on page 585 of our packet that the strikeout of the previous language also strikes out sections B and C that talk about enforcement. And I'm wondering how, given that our sign codes have not been enforced and this adopting of regulations will allow us to enforce again, what is our enforcement mechanism?
I need to take a quick look at this.
There is some enforcement of our sign code, though, correct?
First of all, if I can just sort of say that the 585 is, I believe, an attachment to the Planning Commission packet.
That's also, it's also included in, as an attachment to the ordinance.
It's the same as the ANC language in the ordinance. Okay, very good. So, Mr. Arnold, can you point me to the section you're particularly...
Section B and C talk about violations of the sign provision can be brought in conformance and gives the... And item C authorizes the planning official to remove without notice temporary or special signs. And I'm wanting to make sure that we have both of those capabilities under the new code.
I don't know offhand. Let's see, where did we... But certainly, I think we have the authority to do that sort of thing without it being in the sign code. I know city attorney might want to comment on that. But one of the things that we certainly want to bring up, kind of want, maybe number one on the list in the phase two, is how to handle those off-site signs that we get a lot of complaints about, but we have, those are what we have kind of laid off of heavy enforcement for the last few years after the Blazing Bagel case. But I'm not answering your question, am I?
Well, C certainly looks like something we would be able, we'd have the authority to do. It just states that planning official may remove any sign that's in violation of the code, this chapter.
I think it's a good comment, Deputy Mayor Arnold. I think we want to make sure as we move forward and toward the second phase to make sure that we've not inadvertently removed, important enforcement language. Yeah. And so that's, I've noted it, and we'll make sure that that hasn't inadvertently happened.
Okay. Very good.
Because I think it is good to have it expressed in the ordinance so that we have a game plan for how to enforce.
Thank you. Mr. Nixon and Ms. Clodo.
Thank you. Yeah, I have a couple of specific questions that have arisen as a result of some concerns that we've received from the community recently about handheld signs used to advertise businesses. And the concern is partly content-based, and we know we can't regulate based on what the signs say, but people are also very concerned about what is done with the signs, that they're being spun and juggled, and there's all kinds of actions that the human being holding the sign is doing in order to attract attention to the sign. And the concern that's been expressed is that these are distracting and potentially distracting to drivers. And I note that there's some language that's not amended. It's being left behind in the code that one might think could apply to these situations. But for the fact that the code talks about specifically how the movement of the sign is actuated and not addressing the movement itself. So, for example, if you look at 100.85, this is on e-page 581, prohibited devices. And under that section 1, subsection C, it's prohibited to use twirlers, propellers, and wind-activated devices. And in subsection F, it's prohibited to have any sign that rotates, turns, or moves by electrical or mechanical means except barber poles. And so my question is, do we understand the history behind these provisions? Were these prohibitions against moving signs made because of the potential for distracting drivers and potential increases in traffic accidents or whatever as a result? And if that's the case, why does it matter that it's wind-activated versus human-activated? Or why does it matter that it's electrically or mechanically activated rather than human-activated? And if it's the distracting motion that we're trying to address, could these also be made to apply to signs being wielded by a human being?
Can I maybe take a shot at the historical question?
Please.
Because I don't think this was adopted for the reasons that you're raising.
Okay.
It's a very logical reason that you're raising, but I think it was more of an aesthetic reason, frankly. It was about wanting to moderate the garishness of signs, pennants, banners, twirlers, all those things. I think it was more for that reason rather than, although motor vehicle distraction might have been kind of in there as well, but I think primarily it was for more aesthetic reasons. So that's as far as I will go. The city attorney may want to weigh in on.
I guess I'd add that when you first read them, they read as time, place, and manner restrictions.
Right.
And to the extent that it's a garishness issue and it's content neutral, they would likely withstand constitutional scrutiny. To the extent that they're based on something like traffic safety, I would consider them, you know, legally no different than, you know, a modern day placard waiver. It's the same kind of motion. It doesn't matter whether it's wind or arm driven. I would think the same legal analysis would attach. And there have been a number of cases at the Washington Supreme Court level, at the U.S. Supreme Court level, the Ninth Circuit, where jurisdictions have limited off-site signs based on motion on a content-based basis and citing traffic safety and community aesthetics as reasons, and they've all failed because when it comes right down to it, somebody waving a political sign and, you know, something that's fluttering or by a mattress all have the same potential to distract a driver. And so even if you're limiting commercial and not non-commercial speech, the courts have said we take content neutrality very seriously and don't rely on commercial speech enjoying less constitutional protection. If what you're trying to legislate is traffic safety, you better be able to explain why a political sign being waved is less distracting than a commercial sign being waved to buy a mattress. And those kinds of cases have fallen apart. So if Eric's right, that might be a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction. But if it's construed as being in support of traffic safety, it would be problematic and I think no different than somebody saying buy a mattress.
Okay, so from an aesthetic perspective, we could ban all handheld sign waving in the city, but it would literally have to be all, so it would be content neutral.
Mm-hmm.
And that would mean that even during the last 3 weeks of a campaign, you couldn't have political sign waivers.
That's right.
I mean, as long as you don't wave them or move them.
Oh, if you hold them still, could we say you can hold them still but not wave them?
Well,
the person can move, but the sign can't.
If what you're saying, I mean, there's the enforcement issue that we come back to, but if what we're saying is you can't wave stuff because it's distracting to drivers, you better allow everything or you better ban everything. And if you're going to ban everything, we would have to have a very strong factual predicate. We'd have to have a compelling state interest. It would have to be narrowly tailored. The burden would be against us as a government, the restriction would be presumed unconstitutional. It would be tough sledding, but that's how you do it. It would be all or nothing. And then the same kind of analysis would apply to an off-site sign that doesn't involve motion. It would be sort of all or nothing. And going back to the comment that Mr. Asher made about Blazing Bagels, I think staff agrees that the Blazing Bagel issue is one that would need to still be looked at in round two, because we've got real estate signs in here, we've got political signs in here, we've got some other things in here, but we haven't really yet grappled directly with the off-site portable sign, whether it's commercial or non-commercial, and I think we'd be looking for some direction from you, because again, it would be sort of all or nothing, and most jurisdictions, I think, are going in the direction of allow it all, because it's so difficult to choose based on content, and it's really hard to tell people you can't have a sign out there on the Monday before election. It's
not that difficult.
Well, that was actually my next question, is in subsection I, 1I of this same section, and this is kind of about a third of the way down, e-page 582. We've removed the except political, private advertising, or off-site real estate signs part of that. But what's left behind is that we're prohibiting any portable outdoor sign. And that seems quite broad. And I'm curious whether that would include handheld signs.
I think as I read that section, Mr. Nixon, I read it as, number one, the amendments to the portable sign provision were really addressing it wasn't content neutral, now it is. But the way I read it is it says that if it's exempt, like a historical placard, or if it's regulated in section 115 or 112, then it's allowed. So there are types of that portable sign that appear in 115 and that appear in the exemptions. That's right. The way I interpreted it.
Things that fall under 100.115 as temporary signs, signs for properties for sale or rent,
right.
Signs for properties without a construction. Yep.
That's right.
Et cetera, et cetera. And
with a footnote that we still need to address Blazing Bagels at some point.
Yeah, I mean, because like in 100.115.40, temporary signs in non-residential zones.
Right.
Which, page 586 at the bottom, 100.115.40. Essentially, it says that temporary signs are allowed during the use, event, or condition advertised on the sign, but not more than 60 days. And a concern I have about that is, you know, you have a store, and it runs a series of sales. It puts something different on sale every 30 days. And so it can have permanent portable signs just by having it advertise a different sale each time. And So, this definition right here in 100.115.40 it creates an exception that would allow basically anything.
So if I can jump in here too, that is almost identical to the existing language in the code.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, again, we were trying in most cases to avoid changing the existing policy.
Right.
And the same response I would have to your comment about the previous section about the exemption for portable outdoor signs. We were taking the content neutrality, we were taking the content, the exceptions for content-based signs out, leaving the existing prohibition in or the existing exception in. However, saying very clearly, we need to have a discussion about that with the council and the community, because I think that's probably the key issue in the phase two, in my mind, is how do we want to deal and how can we deal legally with these portable off-site signs.
And then just a quick add-on, now that I've got the two provisions side by side,
yeah,
the way 180.85 works as it relates to sub I, the portable outdoor sign provision that's been amended to apply to anything other than things that are exempt or things that are provided for in 115. What I would say is that temporary signs in non-residential zones under 115.40 is a species of portable outdoor sign that happens to be regulated.
Right.
And then going to your second point, because when you mentioned that example, I thought of a rug shop in Fremont that I worked near for years. It was always going out of business. And so what I would say to that is, and it goes to Deputy Mayor Arnold's comment about making sure that the enforcement language that we need is there or available, and that is that for parties that try to avoid the plain intent of the ordinance, once we're done, we need to have an enforcement strategy with respect to those. And so we would be looking, I think, in your example, for a way to make sure that this new provision or amended provision is not misused to have, you know, successive 60-day periods.
So to kind of wrap up my questions, it sounds like we're in this phase one eliminating the things that are explicitly content-based, but we're not solving all the problems. No. And some of the things that our community is asking us to address, we're just going to defer to phase two. And this whole question of handheld signs is one of those things that we're deferring.
Yes, and I would also say off-site portable signs in the non-political context.
Right. Thank you.
I think that's fair.
And we're not eliminating those that are explicitly content-based either.
No.
But it's good enough. It's good enough.
Ms. Clova. Been waiting patiently.
So back to when you were discussing the motion-based signs and whether and you suggested sort of, you know, we could come up with a ban all of them, you know, no matter what the source of their movement was. But you were saying, I just want to kind of clarify, you would have to, the burden of proof would be to really prove an actual traffic danger and actual driver distractibility that causes accidents rather than maybe just a perception that we all have. I mean, you'd have to get some data in order to really support a ban at all.
Yes. I had the same question. Couldn't we just say we don't think that these are fit with our community character, waving signs, and we're just not going to allow sign waving? Could we do that?
Well, if...
Do you mean just human-powered, or do you mean any kind of sign that moves in any way, shape, or form?
I guess I just mean human-powered.
Or so either way, for the sake of argument. Than how...
I guess...
That's I'm asking the exact same question you are.
Because if movement is, like, tacky, then why does it make a difference? I mean, I'm trying to sort this out for myself
as
well.
Yeah, me too.
Isn't tacky content?
I think we're asking...
No, I think that would be manner or character... of it.
Yeah. So on this issue and on any issue when we would be stepping in to regulate in particular non-commercial speech, but commercial speech as well, well, let's stick with non-commercial, which is, you know, somebody waving a political sign. You start out with a presumption that a restriction on non-commercial speech is assumed to be unconstitutional. The burden is on the agency to show that it serves a compelling state interest, that it's narrowly tailored, that there was not a less intrusive basis upon which to address the issue, such as a time, place, or manner restriction. And then if the asserted compelling state interest is community aesthetics, or in this case traffic safety, we would have to be prepared to prove it. And the jurisdictions that have tried have failed. But that's because the jurisdictions that have tried it and failed have said, we're not going to try to tell a candidate that they can't wave a sign, mm-hmm. but we are going to tell a mattress store that they can't wave a sign. And what's happened in that instance is the courts have struck that down by saying you can't demonstrate that waving a political sign is more distracting or less distracting to a driver than than saying buy a mattress, here's, you know, turn right here. And so if you really were, if an agency was really prepared to ban waving all signs, including political signs, then and there was a strong factual predicate to show that waving signs is distracting, an agency, I think, could take a run at that, but it would be very difficult. And other jurisdictions haven't tried it. It would be difficult, but it would need to be content neutral, so it would be across the board, all types of speech, which is just a big, you know, nut to crack.
If I may, I don't think you have to prove that if you base it on the community aesthetics. If you base it on a safety issue, I think you'd have to prove it. But the community aesthetics, that's you fine. Are establishing the aesthetics in your by the passage of your code.
Well, the waving issue would...
No. I'm not I'm talking about you have to do all of them, but you wouldn't have to necessarily prove that it is a distraction and it's a safety, unless you're basing it on a safety issue.
Yeah,
aesthetics. If you're basing it on a community aesthetic.
I was addressing motion.
Yeah, okay.
You know, the aesthetics issue is different, and it goes back to the garishness issue that, you know, I think most jurisdictions would try time, place, and manner restrictions first before going there.
Mr. Arnold.
I think we're starting what is going to be a very long and interesting discussion on phase two. So I would like to move ordinance 04532 in its summary relating to zoning, planning, and land use and amending chapters 5 and 100 of the Kirkland Zoning Code regarding definitions and regulations to ensure content neutrality in sign regulations and approving a summary of ordinance for publication, file number CAM 16-00954.
Thank you. Moved by Deputy Mayor Arnold and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to approve Ordinance 4532. Ms. Clova.
So I'll hold off on the long discussion that I was going to launch into about community aesthetics and who gets to say what is the community aesthetics.
Those that show up.
yeah. Interesting. So... we were given two pieces of paper on our thing, and they are identical except for the insertion of between 30 days prior to and. That's inserted on one. What one are we considering?
I think it was mentioned, but I didn't hear.
That's the old one. So the correct one.
Because we have both.
Yeah, so the correct one is the one that says... that actually has the item number printed on the top, 11D, and it just says no later than 7 days after the final election.
Okay, so we're getting rid of the notion of this 30 days prior.
Yes. Right.
So this, we're, okay.
Any further discussion? Mr. Asher?
I just want to remark that the planning director has my entire packet with all my notes and things, so I will not... delve into that tonight. I'll save that for phase two.
Mayor?
I'm going to refer this to a committee.
Mayor?
Yes, sir.
Point of order. I think Councilmember Kloba has moved an amendment to the primary motion from Deputy Mayor Arnold, and I didn't hear a second to the changing, removing the 30 days.
No. I'm asking which of these two pieces of paper that we have on here is...
Oh, I'm seeing. Okay.
The staff recommendation.
I think the ordinance that was before you includes the 30 days, so I think it would be appropriate for there to be a secondary motion amending that language so that the 30-day requirements are removed.
I moved what's in the packet.
Okay.
He moved this one.
Right.
This is the one. Right.
What Deputy Mayor Arnold moved is in the packet, so we need to amend it to
remove
this new language to it.
So I move to amend the proposed ordinance to the language that has section 100.15.30, subsection 4, to read permitted duration no later than 7 days after the final election.
Thank
you. Second.
Okay, it's been moved by Councilmember Kloba, seconded by Councilmember Asher, to amend the main motion so that section 100.115.30, item 4, reads permitted duration no later than 30 days after an election.
7 days after the election.
No later than 7 days after an election. Yeah. Excuse me. Discussion? Moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Kloba. Ms.
Other
Kloba?
Way, other way around.
Moved by Councilmember Kloba, seconded by Councilmember Asher. I am so sorry, guys.
No problem.
I just want to state, I really do support the 7 days, and I just, we all have experienced this, but a campaign sign before the election is good marketing, and a campaign sign after the election is garbage with your name on it. So I totally support this.
All right. We have an amendment to the main motion before us. Would all those in favor of it please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed say no. Thank you very much. The amendment is approved. And now the question is on the main motion. It's moved by Deputy Mayor Arnold and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to approve the ordinance 4532 as amended. I believe we need a roll call vote, please, Ms. Anderson. If there's no other discussion... I see none. Thank you. The roll, please. Councilmember Nixon?
Aye.
Councilmember Kloba?
Aye.
Councilmember Asher?
Yes.
Councilmember Sweet?
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Aye.
Mayor Wallen? Aye. Thank you very much. The ordinance is approved. So now, do we need to talk about phase two, or do we have a plan, or how's that going to go? What's your recommendation?
So our intent, if you have the stamina for it, is to at least get some preliminary direction on the kinds of things you'd like us to include in phase two. We have some suggested topics. We want to make sure we capture the universe of them as we begin the work on phase two.
Yes, sir.
I liked all the things on your suggested topics, and I've got a number of others that I will email to Dorian and Eric.
Can you send them to us, too?
Sure.
So I just want to have other comments from council members on other topics.
I think there's going to be quite a lineup here, I think. Mr. Arnold.
In addition to some of the discussion that had been started on live people signs, one option that I would like to consider is putting those in the temporary time-based limitation and see if we had some mechanisms where we would allow people-powered signs, but only on a temporary basis based on number of days a year. Because, as we've discussed, this is commercial speech, it's political speech, it's also the school car wash. There are a number of things that I think, as we look at this, will be pulled into people-powered signs. And maybe a time-based approach is the right way to get at the issues that we've been hearing from the community.
Mm. Other comments, Mr. Nixon?
And, well, another thing that is commonly handheld signs in our community are people at freeway on-ramps asking for money. And so that gets to be a sensitive issue, too. So just saying that needs to be part of that discussion as well.
Ms. Sweet?
And will this also incorporate the, I don't know what they're called, but the people with the ugly Obama pictures and stuff that's set up downtown?
Protesters?
Yeah.
Do you mean people holding those signs on the streets?
Mm-hmm.
Content neutrality. We will not deal with Obama, but yes, they would. Whatever we do would have to apply to those as well. I guess I would, and I appreciate Mr. Asher, whatever you've got to send us, but staff is very interested in just understanding what's on your minds as we go into this next set of amendments so we can focus on the right things and maybe avoid the things that really aren't problems. So that was really why we wanted to queue up some questions tonight. So It doesn't have to be right now, but if you've got future issues that occur to you, you can let us know as well.
Ms. Sweet?
Just a couple things, and I'm sure they're probably on Dave's list, but...
I don't count on it. Go ahead.
Well, clearly, you know, I get lots of complaints, particularly on weekends, with regard to all of the A-frames, so I assume that that's on there in terms of both quantity and size and everything else. And then what was the other one? I wonder if, as we look at this, we want to make sure that we don't sort of broad base one size fits all, so that when we're looking at signage for downtown, we may not be looking at the same criteria for signage at Totem Lake or even on 85th or Bridal Trail. So I think we need to just not box ourselves in where all neighborhoods are concerned.
Mr. Arnold?
And then if I may make a process recommendation that when we see Mr. Asher's list, that we run that through the Planning and Economic Development Committee.
Ms. Clova?
I think if we consider rules that are different one neighborhood versus another, we will want to make sure that we trot it out in front of each and every one of those neighborhoods, because I think the general tolerance for visual clutter is fairly low in just about all neighborhoods. And setting up, you know, if the reason that we don't want as many signs has to do with a community aesthetic, I think setting up one part of our community to have a different aesthetic than another might be problematic. The other part that I would want to make sure that we're approaching as we talk about where signs can be located, really being careful about obstructing the sidewalks, because I think that we have some guidance on, you know, not blocking sidewalks, but that doesn't mean that they don't, and so making sure our enforcement language is appropriate, because I think as we think of ourselves as a very pedestrian-oriented community, we need to make sure that we're not obstructing the sidewalks.
Yeah, obviously I have a lot of feedback on signs because I've had a lot of experience installing them with our business, and it's onerous and difficult and really expensive, and master sign plans and $50,000 and just planning money is kind of an absurd result in my opinion. I want to echo what Councilmember Sweet was speaking of, and if we imagine that Totem Lake goes the way we think it will, with very tall buildings, kind of like a downtown Bellevue, the aesthetic there will and the signage there will be very different from historic downtown Kirkland on the Lake. And I think it is going to be a difficult conversation. I'd like to make sure that our business community is involved, that we have neighborhoods, but we also have businesses that have interests, and it's important that we listen to them and hear their concerns. We've had quite a few experiences with people trying to bring signs from other businesses that they owned in other towns and not being able to, and, you know, is it really what we want, that someone throws a $20,000 sign in a dumpster because it's 4 inches too wide? Or, I mean, I think, you know, we've talked, right. Kurt and I have talked about this a lot over the years, and I think we can do better. I really do, on both ends, on not having visible clutter, but also having an efficient system for allowing businesses to point out where they're located. So I'm hopeful about the process and interested to hear how it goes. And that's all I have. Maybe I have more. I'm not sure. Maybe I might have more. I'll look forward to getting your email, sir.
I'm about to send it.
Excellent. Okay. So we have approved our ordinance, which was our goal. And I think we're ready to move on to reports. The City Council Regional and Committee reports. Mr. Nixon?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. LaLiberty. Thank you for your presentation, Dorian. Thanks for your service.
So, things that have happened recently. On September 22nd, Councilmember Arnold and I
attended and were panel members at a program on sustainable growth that was presented by the Sustainability Foundation based here in Kirkland at Lake Washington Institute of Technology, and a very interesting presentation on how we can work together to accommodate growth in a sustainable way. September 22nd, that same night, we had our all-city dinner to honor all of our city volunteers, or at least the volunteer members of our boards and commissions, and was well attended. Several of us, most of us, I think, were at the Kirkland Urban Groundbreaking on September 28th. Very exciting to see the work that's going on there. I attended a WCIA-sponsored training on Growth Management Act, Comprehensive Planning, Public Records Act, and Open Public Meetings Act, all packed into 3 hours in Burien on September 28th.
60,000 feet.
Yeah. But actually, they had quite a few interesting details on the foundations underpinning the Growth Management Act and the authority of the government to do planning and things I hadn't heard before.
Cool.
And of course, we all know this is National Walk to School Week. Councilmember Sweet and I kind of kicked it off on Monday at Juanita Elementary, and I know that we also had firefighters and police officers there, and it continues throughout this week at other schools, and I know we're all planning on attending various days. In terms of things coming up, just wanted to remind you all that the Sound Cities Association networking dinner is tomorrow evening in Kenmore. Very nice not to have to drive to Renton at rush hour. Thursday night, there is a Pacifica Institute program on community policing, which I plan to attend. I don't know if anybody else is planning on that, but I'll report back on what they have to say. This is a Muslim group, and so their perspective on community policing should be very interesting.
Where is it?
At the Pacifica Institute in Bellevue. Yeah. And I can give you the details. And then October 12th is the next Sound Cities Association Public Issues Committee meeting. And as I previously noted, I won't be able to be there. I don't know if Councilmember Kloba, as our alternate, can be there. But I wanted to make sure that we would have coverage.
I can do that.
October 12th. Okay. And there's another opportunity on October 12th that I want to mention. A Cub Scout den has been working on new ideas for improving Totem Lake Park and wants to present those ideas to a council member. Awesome. Unfortunately, I'm gone on October 12th. I'd love to do it. I sent out an email with the details, and I don't know if any of you might be available that evening to receive this report from these Cub Scouts. Amy will do it. Thank you very much, Madam Mayor. That's all I have.
Thank you, Ms. Kloba. Well, I'm a little bummed that you tricked me into going to the PIC meeting before you pitched that one, because one of these things is not like the other.
In Renton.
In Renton. Yes.
So, yes, I will go to the PIC meeting for you, and I will find a way to enjoy it. I know I will. So I had the pleasure of getting to do the walk to school festivities this morning at Thoreau Elementary, and was delighted that even though I woke up to rain, the sun had come out and everything was beautiful by the time the children were walking to school. And as always, I wish the firefighters were still here, but they are really the hit of the morning. And I even saw a couple little brothers coming along with bigger siblings, and they were wearing their little firefighter gear. So it was very, very cute. And passed out lots and lots of vests. And I noticed as I was going by one of the classrooms, class had already started, the children are still wearing their vests inside of the classroom. So they really, really like them. And one of the PTA moms said, oh yeah, they wear them all year long. So if you were wondering about the efficacy of passing out those vests, they do continue to wear them. And then I just wanted to check in. We heard earlier adding the Houghton Transfer Station, the closure of the Houghton Transfer Station issue to the Parks, Public Works, Human Services Committee. We all had agreed on that. And then I just wanted to make sure that we're also adding the summary of that focus strategies and all home closure. Did we want to do that just to my committee, or do we want to request that we get a report to the full council? I didn't want to drop that thread.
I'd be interested in that. Yeah, I'd like to see it.
Yeah. Okay. Could we put that on an upcoming agenda? Okay. That's all I have then. Thank you. Mr. Asher.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Thing that was mentioned earlier tonight that I'd like to see us pick up is the during the budget discussions is the support staffing for our human services efforts and move that to a human services commission. We talked about it in committee. We thought it was there, but apparently it didn't get included in the budget discussions. So if we can add that to our budget discussions, I think it would be well worthwhile in seeing the quality of what these folks are putting out. We need that, and I think when you see the size of the efforts in other cities, but you say we need to be doing some more than what we've got.
So you'll be able to bring us some information about what that cost would be, staffing that?
Right. So what we could do is just include options in the budget discussion October 27th, so the council would have. There's certainly capacity in what you'll get to make that decision. So we could lay out what those options might be, and you could make a choice.
Okay, sounds cool. Good. I know we're going to have a lot of asks in the realm of human services, because I'm about to make one, too.
Yeah. There's, to follow up on a regional transit committee discussion that we've had, it's an ongoing discussion with the Metro's long-range plan. A couple of staff members are coming this Friday to talk about a couple of issues I've been raising. One is Metro currently, when high capacity transit goes into an area, let's say into the University District, all of the bus hours stay in that geographical area. They don't use those bus hours to redistribute to high priorities. And the flip answer out of the last executive director from Metro's was makes the community conversation a lot easier, but it makes it a heck of a time when you're prioritizing. We've got over 600,000 hours short in buses, bus hours that we need. So we're going to tackle that, and I'm going to talk about some techniques with this staff. Another key aspect that's coming down the road with Metro is they've have plans to really do some great things using our money. They are calling it partnerships, and partnerships meaning they'll do service where we can do the capital and maybe do the maintenance. And so we're looking at the discussion this week is how much time do we need ahead of time for them to say, okay, here's what we need along these potential routes in the future for us to be able to program it and be able to begin to build it in our capital budgets. They haven't had a good track record of planning over the long term, particularly with other jurisdictions. So this is a key area for us to get additional bus service. And for the next 25 years, that's going to be the only bus service we're going to have. So we're working that through, and it'll be working through the Regional Transit Committee. But I just wanted to let you know those are two issues that I'm working with them on those particular ones.
Those are big ones. Thank you, sir.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Sweet.
I don't have much. Lots of breakfasts this week. We had the Wildlife and Recreation Breakfast in Seattle. LifeWire Breakfast, I think, was on Friday. Was it yesterday? Anyway, well attended. It was a great event, always is. Kind of small, I thought, but were you there? You were introduced.
I was supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm. That's okay. I waved at you.
Thank you.
I also, last week, I participated by phone in an hour and a half meeting with the organization that King County has hired to do the ALS evaluation with regard to the recommendation that for EMS around evaluating what process they will be using to identify how you identify a new agency, how you decommission an agency that might be withdrawing from the system. It's a very high-powered group. I can't remember what it is right off the top of my head, but it's these guys are experts from all over the country who are working together to try and figure out kind of everything from sort of the tribal aspect of it to what's the most efficient delivery system to get out there. And they were, I know that Seth has already been interviewed by them in one of his ALS capacities. They are not doing the BLS lead agency work. This is only around pretty much your issue, Kurt, that we laid out when we finalized the EMS stuff last time.
Are they going to tell us how we get our team from Redmond?
We talked a whole lot about that.
Good.
So it was a very interesting conversation. They were very forthcoming and non-political.
We're non-political either.
Yeah, but aware of a lot of the politics of it. But it's all anonymous fact-finding, and it was fascinating. Also, yesterday went to an all-day retreat for the KDA. We will see some stuff coming out of this. This was facilitated, came up with the mission statement, reevaluated what the KDA is doing. We're going on a merchant hunt, starting merchant meetings again this Friday. So we all have our marching orders. And then, Toby, you sent out an email about the community conversation that SCA is hosting around library services. Mm-hmm. And I think I volunteered to go to that. That's in Bellevue. I think it's next week sometime. So I'm going to try and connect with is it Deepa, who's our chair of the library board?
I think it's
Kevin. Okay. I'll try and connect with Deepa before. I think she's planning on going as well. That's all.
Thank you. Mr. Arnold.
On September 22nd, Councilmember Sweet, Councilmember Nixon, and Councilmember Asher joined me at the All-City Dinner.
Oh, yeah.
Staff provided service for the meals, and we did a little bit of a different format this year where we talked about each board and commission's work for the year and wrapping up with the city manager's State of the City presentation. It's always a good time to hear the incredible amount of work that all our volunteers do on board of commissions. And that was a fun evening. And then I would just second what Councilmember Sweet is saying about Walk to School. The firefighters were a big hit. I was at Ben Franklin this morning, and firefighters from Station 22 had a long line of enthusiastic kids interested in climbing into the engine, taking a tour, taking pictures, and our firefighters were great.
And can I add, police was great, too. Jeff Trombley was where were we? Juanita. And he was really well-received. It's just really interesting to me to see the kids that gravitate towards the police and the kids mm-hmm. that gravitate towards the fire. Little girl was going for wanting to be a police officer. Her little brother cool. having none of it.
It's great.
But my plan is to go to Peter Kirk and Frost yet, so...
Thank you. Well, the only thing I have left to report on is that I attended a meeting with the Arch Cities, some staff, some electeds. Kurt gave a presentation, and Representative McBride gave a presentation. And we just had an update on Arch and their units that they funded from 1993 to 2002 was about 1,800. And from 2003 to 2013, when probably the need is so much greater,
they were only able to develop 1,054 units, and the cost of land, we all know it's stating the obvious, but a cost per unit has grown from $109,000 to $210,000, but the Arch City's funding level goals have not been updated since 1994. Arthur Sullivan gave this presentation and talked about the need and about workforce housing and all the things that we talk about all the time. And he said, you know, is it time for us to revisit our funding goals? And it was definitely an opportunity to show our leadership and say yes. I would say that some of the cities in the Arch, it was not as hearty and enthusiastic endorsement of the concept as I would have thought. But I think it's Kirkland's time to show leadership, and we need to show them the way. So I don't know where to go from here. Should we have Arch come out and give a presentation? I mean, obviously you're very engrossed in this subject. What's your recommendation?
So a couple things. Obviously, first in the budget process, you can make your own decision about whether you want to, you know, show some leadership by increasing a contribution to the Arch Trust Fund. So that's going to be one of the topics we'll discuss in the preliminary budget proposal, because I am going to be recommending some increases to that amount. What Arthur is proposing, which is a much longer conversation, is should we relook at the underpinnings of the calculations we use to suggest people's contributions? And we want to make clear that we keep reminding folks that Arch is a collaborative and it's not compulsory. So we can't, Arch doesn't tell cities what to give, Arch suggests what cities should give. And we try to base it on some rational formulas, which include population and assessed value and other things. But we haven't revisited the amounts or the formulas for, you know, decades. And so we were looking for some direction from the sort of focus group of elected officials, is should the Arch Board start to take this up? And I think we got some general majority nods that we should, but that would probably work. It would come back to the council sometime next year, and we would suggest, you know, maybe new ways to look at how we would do the funding allocations and new suggestions as to the amounts. But that's a big work program for the board. So part of it was just testing with this council, is that something you'd like to see the Arch Board take on? Because we felt like it was probably a worthwhile topic.
Penny?
I think definitely. I mean, we've all seen what's happened with property values, and it's clear in the cost of construction and everything else. We're going to have to up the ante, and I think we've already stepped up to it to a large degree, but I think we should include that consideration in our budget planning.
I wonder if we could get this presentation to the whole council.
Oh, certainly.
It is really good, and talks about each city's contribution and land prices, and it's very detailed. It's really good.
Yeah, we can get that out to the full council. It's a nice summary document.
I'd like to see how we would develop a strategy to pass a housing levy in Kirkland. Mm-hmm.
That was one of the items for discussion, was should the Arch cities or individual cities try to pass a levy?
Yeah, the Arch cities, I don't think it'll pass. I think Kirkland, with the right education, and it's a public information campaign, I think could. And I think it would be worth doing. Probably take us several years to get ready, but if we could put that on a work plan, developing a pathway to a successful housing levy, I think that's the only way we're going to work to make meaningful contributions to this. And I think the populace would do it if they if we could tell them why they should care about housing.
We've definitely discussed it. Well, I think you have your answer. Okay. As far as the council is supportive that the Arch Board should pursue this. And I think this housing levy conversation is ongoing, because I think there's interest in the council on that. And we'll be putting together our work plan very soon.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. So now it is time for the calendar update from the city manager.
Thank you. So just two quick policy updates before we get to the council calendar, both related to public safety. So First, as you know, we've been having very good conversations with Evergreen Health about potentially finding a way to use some of their properties to locate our new Fire Station 27. We had a second big meeting that included Bob Malte and his team, Marilyn and I, Joe Sanford, the whole group, and we had some great discussions about two or three properties and ways this thing might work. There's a lot of complications and cost differentials, and so one of the things that Bob Malte suggested to us is that if we could, they have a parking lot that's by a stream that they own that basically the current regulations make very difficult for anyone to develop, except possibly public agencies under a public use exception. So what he offered to us is that if we could figure out a way to make that parcel work, that they might be willing to transfer that to us. So one of our interesting first tests of whether we can make the new codes work is to look at this parcel and see if it's something that we can actually pull off. So we've started that process, and we have a lot of work to do, but I would start by saying it doesn't appear to be impossible. But how exactly the path we'd go is going to be interesting. So if that doesn't work, there's a couple other options we're working on with Evergreen Health, but I just wanted you to know they're being very supportive and very cooperative, and we're really trying to find a way to get something that could work up there. So, second, this one is with my hat as a board member on the Joint Board for the Peace and Radio Project. In general, it's going very well, but there's been a new issue that's been raised by the city of Seattle, which is real, but it's also something that there's no easy answer for. And when the ballot measure was passed, the definition of coverage that was built into the RFP that was done by King County was 97% coverage for emergency radios everywhere in King County at the street level, which is a very high standard and one of the highest actually in the nation. But that doesn't mean inside buildings. So one of the challenges that's come up with Seattle is the whole amount of the levy was predicated on building enough towers to make sure that anywhere in King County and anywhere in Seattle on the street you have this coverage. But when you get into big glass modern towers that are extraordinarily reflective, the digital technology has a harder time getting in. And so Seattle has pointed out that when the levy passed, they were still not in the resurgence that they had today. They have 40 more towers that are at least 40 stories or higher on in their permit process right now. So their downtown is going to just almost double. And this is an issue that's also somewhat of an issue for Bellevue, which is also starting to build big towers. So the levy is not sized to deal with this issue, and it's not really the job of the levy to deal with this issue, but the job of the levy is to provide emergency communications that work when people run into buildings. So we're starting to highlight it as something that we've got to figure out a way to deal with. We don't have a solution yet. The current basic technology today is essentially put a bunch of repeaters inside and boosters inside these buildings. And so it may just be that each jurisdiction is going to have to do that if they have those kind of buildings. But so I just want to put that on your radar screen. It's still a very collaborative discussion, but it's just really one of these sort of emerging things that comes out of growth that you don't think about when you pass, you know, a levy the first time. So we're trying to work our way through that, but there could end up being recommendations that come back out of this to come back to all the regional entities. So
why couldn't that be a building component?
Just right.
Like sprinkler.
So that's one of the things we're looking at is, do you just require that as the development, you know, and
right.
Those kinds of things. So. So those are my two major updates, like I said, related to public safety and the council calendar. Just a reminder, we have the October 27th meeting, 3 to 9 p.m., so all day. But want to see if there's any other suggestions for the council calendar between now and the end of the year.
Can't believe it's nearly the end of the year already, or we're planning for it. Any updates from the council? My gosh.
It's not on my calendar.
No.
Oh, my calendar. Oh, no, there it is.
Yep. Oh, there was. There. I should say there's one.
Six hours. Let's do this.
27th?
Yes.
27th. 3 to what?
9.
Or 9, yeah, 9.
3 to 9. But you could get done early. As Ron Sims always used to say to the King County Council, if you just accept my budget now, you can be done. Right? So you could go as fast as you want if you just think it's a great budget. So we do have one thing that we are working on that might come back to this calendar, which is a concept of a Totem Lake 2.0 resolution. Most of you are at my city, all city dinner update, and we have sort of realized how much growth is happening, particularly in Totem Lake. You know, 49% of our housing development is in the pipeline for our 20-year plan. And so really taking a look at how our capital projects are set up to deal with that growth, and maybe we need to switch some things around and front load some projects that were in the back end of the CIP. So a couple years ago we did this where we passed a resolution that gave us direction to prioritize that sorts of things. And so we're looking at maybe coming back to you with something like that that was suggested by Deputy Mayor Arnold and Mayor Wallen as a way to get our arms around what we might need to do given the kind of extraordinary multifamily growth that could happen in Totem Lake in the next couple of years.
Would that front load some transportation projects?
Right, exactly. Front load transportation projects, maybe front load the Totem Lake park development, so we're looking at those kinds of things. And maybe this is the time we really do need to get out with new signage and street names and those kinds of things because it's just all happening really fast.
They just won't have any content on them.
Right. That's right. So, but that's all I have. So unless you have any other calendar changes, then that's all I have, Madam Mayor.
Anything else for Mr. Triplett? Okay. Well, we did an awful lot of work tonight, and it was quite a lot of fun. So thank you very much. We're adjourned.
Thank you.